representative from District 50, which is Gresham area. I'm serving first term in the House and served in the Senate 9 years.
And I'm Phil Barnhart. I'm state representative from Central Lane and Lynn County, the House District 11. That includes Cresswell, Coburg, Brownsville, Leeburg, and the area in between, and a little piece of Eugene where I live.
And I'm Sam.
Yes, John Hauser. I'm the committee administrator for the House Environment Committee.
We are very pleased to be here in Portland today and with Portland State University. I would like to turn it over to Dr. Christina Hubby, and thank you very much for letting us come to the PSC.
Thank you. Chair Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Christina Holden, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Theology here at Portland State University. On behalf of President Bernstein, it is my pleasure to welcome you to campus for this hearing. We are in the second week of spring term. Classrooms are full. Students and faculty are busy and until today, many of them continue to focus on academics. We're very proud of our students here at Portland State, and I hope you've had an opportunity to meet and talk with some of them during your visit here today. It is appropriate that the committee would choose to hold this hearing at Portland State because sustainability and public service are key elements of our curriculum and of the operations of the university. My testimony today highlights some of the diverse work that is being done by faculty and students in the areas of environmental quality, climate change, and their connections to Oregon's economy, the health of Oregonians, and livability. Development of effective public policy requires research that interweaves science, engineering, public health, and urban planning. At PSU, this work involves dozens of faculty members in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, from UC, College of Engineering and Computer Science, and the College of Urban and Public Affairs. For example, within the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, the Department of Environmental Sciences and Resources is home to the Center for Lakes and Reservoirs, a center established by state law, to address invasive aquatic species management in Oregon. Current departments of physics, chemistry, and the Center for Science Education are home to scientists studying atmospheric trace gases and particulates and their effects on both regional and global climate. Those studies use a combination of observational data sets along with computer models built here at PSU. And then the C College of Engineering researchers are investigating how energy consumption, building construction, and transportation planning relate to climate change, air quality, and livability. In the College of Urban and Public Affairs, researchers are investigating transportation models, land use planning, and the public health impact of climate change. The new $1.7 million NSF-funded Feedbacks Between Urban Systems and Environment project is a collaborative effort among faculty from several of these departments. The goal of the project is to develop an integrated analysis framework that can be used to study the complex interactions among urban infrastructure, urban climate, air pollution, and adaptive and reactive changes in human activity, linking both science and policy. A vital component of environmental research at Portland State is collaboration with state and local agencies, including the Oregon Departments of Environmental Quality and Transportation, Metro, Portland's Public Environmental Services and Sustainability Agencies, community-level organizations, and the Portland State Public Schools. In my own department, geology, we study physical systems that span many spatial and temporal scales. Our current climate and environment research topics include the hydrology of Oregon's North Coastal Lakes and climate watershed, and tree and cascade mountain glaciers, and coastal tsunami hazards. The climate studies might be of particular interest to this committee. Research led by our department chair, Michael Cummings, is finding a profound change in the water balance in the climate basin, away from annual recharge and toward mining of older water resources that were deposited within aquifers more than 10,000 years ago, when eastern Oregon's climate was much moister than it is today. My own work involves decadal to millennial scale change in Antarctic glacial systems, their connections to climate and sea level, including the recent warming-induced ice shelf disintegration events on the Antarctic Peninsula in the news a few years ago. Research conducted across the PSU campus is part of the fabric from which the scientific community crafts its understanding of the Earth environment. Our work can also assist public policymakers in planning for a shared future. The faculty of PSU take the university's motto that knowledge lives in the city to heart, on behalf of the faculty doing work in this area, I want to express our commitment to provide the results of our research to the legislature we never asked. I want to thank you for coming to Portland State. I'd be pleased to answer any questions about my own work or help direct your questions to appropriate members of our faculty.
That's good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks to me as though, looking at your statement, Professor, that we're drying out in Oregon and getting wetter in the oceans. Would that be a fair summary of what you've said so far?
Well, sea level is going up, that's for sure. And parts of Oregon are getting drier. One of the things that we see happening is a shift in the timing of water delivery and shifts in the location where water is being delivered. The studies that are going on in the Klamath Basin, what we're looking at is how stream levels vary over the course of the year, and also looking at the chemistry of the water. And you can tell from the chemistry of the water where it's coming from, if it's that new snow or if it's coming from an older water source. And what we see is a shift toward older water sources in that area. So this is a profound change.
Thank you. Can you tell at this point whether this is a result of reduction in the availability of water in the Klamath Basin, or whether it is an increase in utilization of water in the Klamath Basin, or some combination of the two?
That's a tricky question, and that's something that's being worked on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Holding. I really appreciate your coming. I understand you're teaching class right at this very moment, so it's hard to be in both places at the same time. I think we'll certainly allow you to stay as long as you can, but if you need to, we should appreciate that pressure. Thank you again for allowing us to come to PSU.
Yes, Mr. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's a lobbying that we see later. Streams going down, and my common sense tells me that the retaining water in the mountain in the field area is a passage stream to the river and to the ocean, where we have enough trees and plants which should stay there and slowly discharge their water into the river. At the same time, I don't know what percentage of our state that the land is covered by the aspirate and the buildings, things like that. 1% coverage of the land, total land, certainly, even though it's 1 or 2%, I'm sure it's more, that will have some kind of an impact going into the world.
Yeah, Representative, there are many components in the water balance. And here in Oregon, we care a lot about the snowpack, climbing the snowpack, whether we have any on snow events, how that affects the water moving from the snow into either aquifers or into the river system and to reservoirs or out to the ocean. It's a very complex problem, and I know that people at the University of Oregon are working on models to try to simulate some of the aspects of the circulation. What we're doing here at Portland State is a lot of field work, actually looking at things like, is evaporation changing over time, and how can we provide better measurement systems to look at that? Where is the water that's in the lakes now coming from? Those are parts of this bigger puzzle. And we're also looking at changes in mountain glaciers, and I know my colleagues and his students are developing time series of maps of glacier extent to try to get that part of the balance. But there are many, many terms, and we're really wrestling with getting the terms right, understanding the errors, and putting it all together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That generates another question for me. Yeah. I would love to contact a person from the University of Oregon in my neighborhood who's working on this. Can you tell me who that is? I'm sorry, I missed the last.
Steve
Hoskett,
please.
Thank you. Well, we're certainly happy with the number of moves in terms of physical sciences, earth sciences, and medical science throughout our university system, with PSU and OSU and University of Oregon, all including science, a number of different areas. Program. Several past years I've been moving in the direction of more information about some of the subjects that we're touching on today with global warming, with greenhouse gases, and it's triggered an interest in my own mind, and I've been impressed that through my own college and university experience and doing some research in medical sciences, that oftentimes we can get very overloaded or heavy on one side and overlook the facts on the other side. And so, as I looked at this whole subject over the past few years, it has to me seemed as though we have a number of scientists who have said, the answers are in, pretty well over, let's move on. And I think there is a time for that, obviously. But in my mind, and certainly as I was trained, science is a continuing examination of the facts. We never stop looking at the facts. And as I read the media, I just felt so many times we have acceptance of very outstanding scholars and scientists who have very strong viewpoints, and we've shut down the information-seeking area on the other side. And it was my interest, after attending a very, very interesting, very informative academy that I went to up in Seattle 2 years ago, and then kind of kicked along this last February, that I heard some information that really opened my ears and made me want to seek more. So we have basically invited some folks today that I think are from the other side of the popular views of global warming and greenhouse gas and Kyoto. And so this is in the interest of vetting both sides. I'm not saying that this is the side we come down on. I'm saying let's air the views of both sides and let the public, let us as scientists or as folks that are interested in the subject, take that information and mull it over and come out with hopefully an improved view from where we have this. So it was in that vein that we've invited several of our guests today. I'd like to introduce them all by name right now, and then I'll give you a little of their curriculum vitae as they come to speak. First, we're going to be hearing from Alexandra or Sandy Whittyborn, and then following her, George Taylor from here in the state, and then Dr. Margaret Thorne from Washington, D.C. again, followed finally by Chris Horn. So let me just introduce you a little bit, and then you'll come forward and testify. Sandy Whittyborn currently serves as the Director of Legislation and Policy for the American Legislative Exchange Council, the nation's largest nonpartisan organization of state legislators. In this capacity, she oversees the policy research and legislative operations of the organization. For the past 5 years, Sandy has served as the Natural Resources Task Force Director and Advisor to the Homeland Security Working Group. She's provided testimony at state and federal level and has appeared on a variety of radio and television programs. As advisor to the Homeland Security Working Group, Ms. Bourne has facilitated discussions and developed policy and model legislation that's been introduced at the state level in critical issue areas such as driver's license reform, eco-terrorism, emergency health powers, and critical infrastructure protection. As Natural Resources Task Force Director, she's developed two policy projects, the Energy Sustainability Project and the Environmental Health Initiative. Both of these policy projects seek to educate state lawmakers from a free market, environmental perspective on issues specific to the energy and environment. Prior to joining ALEC in 1999, Warren served as the Deputy Director of the Virginia Department of Conservation and Recreation under Governor Allen. In addition to her management responsibilities for the department, she acted as the agency liaison with other state agencies on issues related to natural resources and health. Warren was elected to the Northern Virginia Soil and Water Conservation District in 93 and served one term before joining the department. She was a candidate for the Virginia House of Delegates in 1995. Prior to her political service, Warren began her career in 1982 as a rehabilitation nurse in Boston, Massachusetts, and served as an officer in the Army Nurse Corps from 1986 to 2003. Pleasure to have you here, Sandy.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much for inviting me to that. I'd like to begin. I do not have a PowerPoint for you. I humbly apologize. My computer had an accident traveling and it is without power. So, but I've done things the good old-fashioned way, and in front of all of you, you have a variety of documents that we use to support our research and policy across the United States in the subject area. And I first would like to turn your attention to a map that is entitled Enacted Greenhouse Gas Regulations in the States from 1997 to 2004. That particular map illustrates current law across the country as it relates to greenhouse gas regulation. I'd like to first set up so you can understand some of those political dynamics as I see it from coming to Washington, D.C. In 2000, with the election of President Bush into the White House, we now have for the first time in the country a Republican in the White House, a Republican majority in Congress, and then for the first time since 1954, a Republican majority at the state level in the state legislatures. Not by much, mind you, but it's a majority. And that has shifted the way we do our work in this country. What has happened is the Congress and the White House have begun to push decision-making down to the states. And under that particular philosophy of government, that's the way they love to see things, which means your plate has been full. You have probably noticed over the past few years a large increase in legislation introduced in your state. Also, the same thing is going on in all 50 states. And there is an average now of about 3,500 bills introduced in each state. And I think if you looked 10 years ago, it was half that amount. So state legislatures have a much larger share of the work in decision making. At that time, back in the late 90s, there was discussion of the Kyoto Protocol, and this all took place at the federal level. It was rejected by the Senate in 1997. It was rejected again by the Senate last year. But what we saw in the past 5 years, and I began tracking this in 2001, has been an orchestrated movement to introduce greenhouse gas regulation at the state level. Oregon is one of the first states to enact a law, and that was back in 1997. Since that time, we watched the legislation increase, and last year we hit a high of approximately 101 bills across the country. This year, in 2005, and I will direct you to the second map, you will see it's entitled Proposed Greenhouse Gas Legislation in the State 2005. As you can see in both of these maps, the way we track legislation, greenhouse gas legislation, we're specifically looking at the term carbon dioxide. It is carbon dioxide that has been targeted because it is the signature of fossil fuel burning for energy. It is a natural byproduct of burning fossil fuels that's released into the atmosphere, much like many of the other processes. What's interesting about this is that carbon dioxide is not a pollutant. Yet, if you've read in the media and in many, many stories, you would think it was because of the way it's being addressed. However, carbon dioxide is indeed an essential element in our ecological cycle. Therefore, we're very cautious about any legislation that seeks to regulate something, which we'll learn from Mr. Taylor and we'll hear, an element that has such unscientific certainty, or has scientific uncertainty right now at the international, the national, and at the state level in terms of the role that carbon dioxide plays in climate change. There has been a slight increase in global temperatures. We think it's human-induced, anthropogenic in nature, but...
I'm sorry, I missed the word.
Anthropogenic. Meaning human-induced. Yes, right. Okay. But there has been great debate over the amount of temperature change that can take place with this, and we heard 5 years ago that it could be up to 10 to 12 degrees. We are now at a point where we're looking at perhaps 1 degree, 2 degrees centigrade. There's still great discussion of this. The concern for us is that we're seeing legislation introduced to regulate stationary sources, and you'll see that on the map, and by stationary sources, we mean power plants, mobile sources of carbon dioxide, which would be vehicles. The green on these maps indicates carbon sequestration programs. The blue is renewable energy portfolio standards. And the yellow on these maps indicates studies that are taking place across the country. And the R that's on these maps, and I'm actually looking at it, I don't see it, but there are several R's that are on here, I didn't come through. Those are greenhouse gas registries. You see that in California, Texas, Wisconsin, in white on one map. Maine, New Hampshire, and through there. Now, why would we be concerned about that? If you look at these maps, and this illustrates perfectly by color, you'll see on the west coast and on the east coast, primarily mandatory regulation of emissions. And then you will see in the Midwest, in the west, primarily carbon sequestration programs. Our concern here is that the states are being set up in an orchestrated movement politically to establish what we will call a carbon cap and trade program. And when you go out to these individual states, and what do I mean by that? Those states that have cap emissions would sell credits for to the states that have carbon sequestration. Carbon sequestration has been promoted to farming communities and to timber communities as a way to make money on a credit market. Emission standards have been established, amazingly, in New England and in the Northwest, because both of those places do not use coal or too much natural gas as a source of fuel. In fact, those two regions of the country primarily are hydrogen-based, meaning water. If you were to look at, for example, here in Oregon, most of your electricity, 73% of it, is hydro-based. It comes from water. Then you have a certain smaller percentage of natural gas and only 8% of coal. So you do not emit that much carbon dioxide from the power plant structure. Most of yours comes from transportation and vehicles. In New York, there has been established under the governors an agreement to have what they call a REGI plan, RGPI, which is a regional approach to going after carbon dioxide emissions and establishing a credit trading program. What's interesting about that is, and in California, they're calling for the same thing. Both of those states in the past 2 years had very high deficits in the billions of dollars in terms of their state revenues. 47 states were in deficit. New York would be,
The states that have cap and trade?
The states that are promoting cap and trade.
Economically,
they have very, very large deficits. Those states would like to sell credits because they are primarily to say that it's cold, which is in the south. Or Pennsylvania, or Maryland, in the case of the not have. There was established a Chicago Climate Exchange in Chicago for the purpose of selling credits. There is not necessarily a dollar value assigned yet, it's just a dollar at the moment. If federal level or the states go forward with a credit trading program, those credits suddenly become more valuable because they're being run by a regulatory program at the federal level. There are companies now, and you can look on the Chicago Climate Exchange website and see which companies have invested into this climate exchange, and you'll see that they are supporting climate control or climate change control legislation and registries in the states. Why? They stand to gain financially in the short term. Our concern here, first, the first industry that would be that would fail under this would be the coal industries, because they emit the most carbon dioxide. Next would be natural gas. We already have natural gas market with prices that are the highest they've ever been. And so on up the ladder to oil. Anything that burns fossil fuel. If we are to have, indeed, sustainable energy, both for global sources and for electricity from stationary sources, we recommend that you have a diverse supply. Alice does not take a position one way or the other over renewable energy sources. If you want to pay for it, that's fine. But we recommend that you have a diverse supply. Let's say that Oregon right now has a proposal, I believe, in the legislature that would provide a fee for any carbon-based fuel that's used, purchased by consumers. If that were to go through, and you had a drought this year or next year, which I think it looks like is happening, you only had 81 inches, I believe, in snowbank at the moment, then your consumers, your citizens, you need to purchase electricity elsewhere. May I remind you of the California crisis that took place in 2001? They had a drought in the northern end. They had a break in the natural gas pipeline in the southern end. They had not built any power plants in over 10 years. They got themselves into a real fix. The consumers for the state wound up buying energy, electricity from Canada and several other states that are fossil fuel based in order to meet their demand. You don't want to put yourself in that position as a state. You want to be able to keep a diverse supply so that you can switch as you need switches. If you had a drought, you need to shift over either to natural gas or coal, or if you put up a nuclear power plant or you have more renewable energy systems. You want to be able to shift with the marketplace or with whatever situation you have before you. That is our recommendation to you, that you not hamstring yourself by capping anything that is carbon-based at this point in time. They would have, ultimately, in the long run, a detrimental effect on your critical infrastructure. Now let's go down to the theory. I have for you, reaching in your place, a book that we have, this is our third edition, we just got this year. It's entitled Energy, Environment, and Economics. In this book, I show you the breakdown of the state of what's been taking place. But I would like to show you, on page 9, what happens to the states that have capped or put into place strong regulations. The top 10 states are Hawaii, New York, Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, Alaska, Connecticut, Rhode Island, California, Massachusetts. Now you have to throw out Alaska and Hawaii. They're standing on the states, they're completely dependent upon themselves. But if you look at these other states, they put strong regulation into place and they now have the highest electricity prices in the country. If you look just below that, you'll see a graph that shows the top 10 lowest state electricity prices, Kentucky through Utah. They have the least amount of regulation as you can see. Now, Oregon is different. Oregon has one of the lowest electricity prices. But that's because much of your energy supply comes from a federal subsidy from the dams that were built many years ago. that part of the reason why your electricity prices are so low. So you're actually on the lower end of that. We urge you not to put yourself inadvertently in a place where you're paying higher energy prices because you're not able to shift to different energy fuel sources over time if you have a drought or you have a change in your supply. The other concern that we have is that those folks that are pushing this carbon cap and trade program, I'm going to ask you to think long and hard about this. Those folks that want to purchase those credits on that Chicago Climate Exchange are going after early action credits at the federal level and will call for credits at the state level. And then they will call for you to increase regulation because that will raise the cost of those credits and will be buying and shifting bills in what they consider a market-oriented approach to regulating or working with climate change. The problem with it is that those folks that have bought most of those credits early would have the largest supply. They would then begin to put themselves into a position what we would call them a carbon credit. Because they own most of the carbon credits, they'll call for regulation, they will make a lot of money, and they can sell when and where they want to. This, ladies and gentlemen, we believe is the context of shame in the long run, particularly for those international.
Can you get at all what happens in California for their
California is a control revenue is very scale of the city who entitled it perfectly, the perfect storm. California has a drought, has a broken natural gas line, had not kept up with its infrastructure, did not really deregulate. Immediately hear that California deregulated, but in fact it was a very state-controlled process. And we find out now that there was some disingenuous price setting on the part of some of the companies.
They stole a lot of money.
Yeah, and they had a governor who wasn't smart enough to do that. So it's very important that you not get yourself into that kind of a bind. So that is not, that is just a storm of all those things coming together without breaking. But part of the problem was the state controlled that marketplace. It wasn't really deregulated, and so the folks that were in charge there went to their buddies and had these great things to do. And it's still funny, I think, about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Isn't one of the problems also in California is that they separated their distribution system from the generation system and essentially required that, thereby putting the distributors over to allow the intermediate position with that fraud that I think you talked about a moment ago?
Correct, but they still had state control place where they were doing the selling and the trade. So it wasn't completely, that was, they only started to be regulated, they didn't need to be that is part of the problem. Either you deregulate or you regulate. You can't go halfway. You really can't go halfway.
Thank you.
So you have before you a variety of papers. You have before you this book. That is the way things look at the moment. We caution you before this cap and trade system that's being set up. We caution you that you do not get entangled in it, that the decisions that you make for Oregon are your own and not part of an orchestrated movement to force a federal or regulatory system for a federal cap and trade system. And I'm open to any questions you may have.
I think we'll hold the questions for now until all of the speakers are speaking. I would like to, because we have a number of bills coming on biodiesel, on mass. I would like to comment later about CO2 from those products. It's a very positive report. Thank you. All right. We're very happy to have George Taylor, our own state climatologist, who did come and speak to the church.
Sure. You may want to move these folks to get them.
Yes.
Well, you are.
Okay.
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 have a PowerPoint presentation and a digital copy there. One color copy and then the 20 black and white. I have a color printer, but I don't want to talk to you. All day. Okay.
I have to get a boy to see you. Is that? Yeah. Oh, here.
Taylor. I'm a state climatologist for Oregon. I'm a faculty member at Oregon State University and been here since 1989 and have spent a lot of time studying this issue. I have a degree in math from the University of California, master's degree in meteorology from the University of Utah, and I'm a certified consulting meteorologist certified by the American Meteorological Society. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to present what amounts to a counterpoint for a lot of what you hear about climate change and global warming. And when I say global warming, what I'm really talking about is human-caused global warming, anthropogenic global warming. So let me just use that as a definition. The greenhouse effect is something that is important, and without it, life on Earth as it exists now would not exist. The greenhouse effect warms the Earth an average of almost 60 degrees Fahrenheit. The way the greenhouse effect works is there are certain gases which are transparent to sunlight. Water vapor is the primary greenhouse gas. Secondary greenhouse gases include carbon dioxide, methane, and some others. And the light from the sun passes through the gases, reaches the Earth, and is converted to heat or long-wave radiation. At that point, these gases absorb some of that heat. With that absorption, the heating of the molecules, so-called greenhouse molecules, that causes the greenhouse effect. Now, some sunlight still escapes to space, some is reflected, but the effect of this is not at all like a greenhouse in someone's backyard, but something much different. It has to do with the absorption of heat by gases, like the transmittal of light. There are certain things that climate scientists tend to agree on and certain things that we tend to disagree on. I'd say we pretty much agree that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, albeit a minor one. Water represents something on the order of 90% plus of the greenhouse effect. CO2 is increasing in the atmosphere, and we think it's largely as a result of fossil fuel emissions. And all other things being equal, an increase in CO2 should cause an increase in temperature. More greenhouse gases would mean some warming. This is a plot of carbon dioxide measured from Mauna Loa. It's been measured there actively since 1958. This just shows the period from 1981 through 2001. And you see a steady increase. The blue is the monthly, and then the red is the annual average. And the monthly values go up and down because the planet breathes. During the summer, vegetation absorbs carbon dioxide. It acts as a fertilizer for plants. and then during the winter there's less absorption. And most of this occurs in the northern hemisphere because there's more land mass and therefore more vegetation. There has been a steady increase. It's pretty much a linear increase, a straight line increase, since the late 50s and probably since the early part of the 20th century. Next, please. So climate scientists agree on some things, disagree on others. Some people say that there's an overwhelming consensus. A phrase I hear a lot is the vast majority of climate scientists believe such and such. I don't think that's true, but even if it were, that doesn't mean that consensus is correct, because science does not operate on the basis of consensus. And I just mentioned in passing three scientists who were all alone with an unpopular theory, who were eventually proven to be correct: Alfred Wegener, J. Harlan Bretz, and Gilbert Walker. Next, please. Most of the state climatologists tend to agree with my point on this. Not that it matters, because we're not dealing with consensus, but among the state climatologists, whose responsibility includes putting current conditions in historical perspective, I'd say about two-thirds of the state climatologists tend to agree with me, and you'll understand what my point of view is as I develop this. Back up one, please, Chris. These blue states here are the states whose state climatologists, I feel confidently, I can state that they agree with me, and I can post their state on the map. Next, please. The ones that I know do not agree with me are the red ones, and then the other ones are somewhere in between. I either don't know them well enough to be able to quote them, or their point of view is not very openly expressed. Well, there are some things that we disagree on, or some disparities in the data that are kind of puzzling. Number one, the global climate is warmed by about 0.3 degrees Celsius, or about a half degree Fahrenheit, since 1979, according to the thermometers that are on the ground. But the weather balloons and the satellites which are launched in the upper atmosphere say that the warming is less than a tenth of a degree, so less than one-third of what's going on at the surface. Now, this is interesting, because the climate model suggests it should be just the other way around. The atmosphere itself should be warming faster than the surface. And having different trends causes different values of climate sensitivity. Now, climate sensitivity here is defined as the amount of temperature increase if carbon dioxide levels were to double compared to the pre-industrial times. And if we use the numbers from the surface and from the climate models, we get values on the order of about 3 degrees Celsius, which is about 5.5 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit. But a much smaller value if we use the atmospheric observations from balloons and satellites. Oh, back up, please. Number three, climate models predict that there should be more warming at the high latitudes, the polar regions. And observations don't show that. And then number four, climate models predict increasing temperature trends with increasing altitude, and observations show just the opposite. So there are some things that we just can't figure out, and things that go opposite to what we would expect if we really understand the greenhouse physics. Some other areas of general agreement: in the next 50 years or so, the Kyoto Accord could reduce temperatures by about 0.05 degrees Celsius, which is less than a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit. Probably couldn't even measure that. This is an estimate that came from one of the members of the Intergovernmental Panel, the UN panel, IPCC. In order to stabilize greenhouse gases, it would take a 60 to 80% decrease in emissions worldwide. There are some things about carbon dioxide and methane that we just can't explain. Methane has been expected to increase for the next 50 to 100 years, and mysteriously, in about 1999, methane leveled off and hasn't gone up since. There are some other things about CO2 that are hard to explain. I think this is a way of saying that there's a lot about the climate system that we really don't understand. And point number seven, some major climate forcings are as yet unquantified. A forcing is something that causes something else to happen. If the sun shines on a clear day, temperatures will warm up. That's a forcing. And volcanoes are a forcing. El Nino is a forcing. There are some major forcings that we really don't understand and have not been able to quantify. There's general agreement also that the frequencies and intensities of tropical and extratropical storms have not increased. Next please. Now some other areas of disagreement. Number five, whether the 20th century was really the warmest in the past 1,000 years. Some people have claimed that. Whether shrinking glaciers and sea ice are indicators of greenhouse warming, if sea level rise will accelerate. Whether there will be an increase in the frequency and intensity of storms and floods and droughts and other natural disasters. Whether global warming will cause agriculture and other economic losses. Some people say yes, some people say no. And finally, whether future global warming will weaken the Gulf Stream and induce a cooling in the Northern Hemisphere. If you saw the movie The Day After Tomorrow, that paints that rather grim scenario. So, how about those models? There are a lot of different models. These are called GCMs, global climate models, or general circulation models. And they attempt to simulate atmospheric processes in somewhat the same way that weather forecasting models do, but they're somewhat different also. And what these do is they are set up to simulate the past and the present, and then used to predict the future. So you can see there's a rather wide range of future predictions from this suite of models. Ranging from an increase of about 1 degree Celsius in the next 80 years to something on the order of 4. But all of them pretty much suggest a uniform increase, pretty much linear, a straight line. And the real difference here in the next 20, 40, 60, 80 years is assumed increases in carbon dioxide. This is basically the result of future carbon dioxide increases as simulated by the models. Next, please. Well, let's take a look and see how the models are doing, if they're able to resolve what's happened in the past and what's happening right now. The models suggest that polar regions should be warming much faster than the tropics or the mid-latitudes. So let's take a look and see if the Arctic and the Antarctic really are warming compared to the other parts of Europe. Next, please. This is the South Pole. The blue line shows the carbon dioxide increases. This goes back to 72, but there's a steady increase again. And then the red dots in the line show the annual temperatures at the South Pole. The same kind of a chart applies to most parts of Antarctica, with the exception of the Antarctic Peninsula, the part that sticks out towards South America, which has had some warming, but most of Antarctica is actually cooling. Here's an Antarctic station at about 78 degrees north. Seasonal and annual. The annual is the black. It's actually not much change in that place, but certainly not warming. Next, please. The Vostok base. This is a site of the very, very deep ice cores that go back hundreds of thousands of years. And again, if anything, there's been cooling in recent years, but no significant warming. So the models are wrong when it comes to what's happened in the past in Antarctica, and so for that matter is greenhouse physics. Again, if the greenhouse gas increases were the primary driver of climate, we should expect to see very significant warming. Next please. In fact, the sea ice around Antarctica is growing in extent. This sort of straighter line with curves in it is the 5-year average in the individual months are shown by the jaggedy stuff. Basically, in the mid 70s, there was a major change that went on in the Pacific Ocean, a regime shift as we call it, and there was a rapid decrease in sea ice around Antarctica. There was a big influx of El Nino events and a lot of changes. But since that time, the sea ice around Antarctica has actually been growing. So we've had now about 30 years of increases in sea ice. How about the Arctic? About 4 months ago, there was a report, a multi-agency, multinational report called the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment that was released that talked about what's been going on in the Arctic and suggested what's going to happen in the future. Next, please. And I want you to notice the first bullet there. It says, The annual average Arctic temperature has increased at almost twice the rate as that of the rest of the world over the past few decades. The past few decades is the part that I want you to latch onto, because there seems to be something rather selective going on when it comes to choosing of the data set. Go ahead, Chris, please. This is a plot of air temperatures in the Arctic from a journal article by Igor Polyakov of Alaska. And this shows what's happened in the Arctic since 1970. An increase that actually seems to have gotten faster in about the last 15 years. Now, what a lot of people are doing is taking that and saying, well, see, there's an increase, and if you project that out 100 years or so, then we're going to see such and such an increase. If we go back a little bit in time and look at the entire record, however, a very different picture emerges. And that is this one. The warmest period in the last 100 years in the Arctic was the 1930s and early 40s. The warmest year was 1937. There was a cooling after that, and there's been a warming since, but the temperatures are still not as warm as they were in the 1930s. A lot of people have talked about the reduction in Arctic ice and the increase in temperatures and danger to the polar bears by looking at that most recent 30-year period and not looking at the whole record. I also want to ask you to just take a look at this graph and notice how many times it shows up in Oregon and in the U.S. and other places. This is a graph that you will see again and again in my presentation. Next, please. Okay, so model predictions are used to estimate future climate, and yet there are really a lot of uncertainties in the climate system. This is a chart that was produced by the Intergovernmental Panel, showing these are the forcings that I talked about, things that cause climate change. Way over on the left are the so-called greenhouse gases, CO2, CH4, N2O, halocarbons, and you see down at the bottom the level of scientific understanding. It's felt that we understand those with a pretty high level of certainty. But notice every other one on there has either a medium or a low, or mostly a very low level of understanding, including some very large effects. And these include clouds, aerosols, land use changes, biomass burning, a lot of things that would actually tend to decrease temperatures rather than increase them. Now, since we really don't know how to model these things, most of the climate models use a disproportionate amount of greenhouse gases in projecting future trends, the one thing that we do understand with some degree of certainty. There's some other things that get snuck in every now and then. This is part of the U.S. Global Change Research Program, and it led to the national assessment about 4 years ago. Now, the drafts of predicted summertime temperatures in the next 100 years show these values. And so in the top one from the Canadian model, it showed temperatures in the Midwest on the order of 10 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit warmer. The Hadley model, just some very small increases. Out here in Oregon, it's showing temperatures on the order of 5 degrees, which they're pretty high. But then when they released the final document, this is what they displayed. All of a sudden, they were all really big and really different. Now it's a little bit different color scheme, but Oregon now is 10 degrees Fahrenheit in the Hadley model, whereas it was just about 3 or 4. So somebody changed some things halfway through the process. Next, please. Another thing that the modelers can't explain is why the temperatures in the upper atmosphere, which are measured from satellites, have not warmed significantly, even though according to greenhouse physics they should have warmed faster. Now this is monthly and annual temperatures recorded by NASA and NOAA satellites back to 1978, and there are peaks and valleys, but very little long-term trend in the temperatures. By the way, these are confirmed by the weather balloons, which are all quite significant in places all over the world.
Why should the upper stratosphere be warming up? Because it's closer to the sun, they get more radiation?
It's mostly because increased warming at the surface causes more convection, which is rising in the air. So if we look at the surface temperatures, which really shouldn't be as high, we actually see a much stronger increase. Well, this is the
So would that increase the air pressure at the higher levels as well as temperature? If that effect were happening, that convection effect we were talking about? I think it's effectively increasing the diameter of the Earth's atmosphere.
Probably not. An increase in temperature would tend to expand the height of the top of the atmosphere, but air pressure is caused by the weight of all the molecules in the atmosphere in a column. So probably the number of molecules would change. You can get an expansion, but it wouldn't change the number of molecules. So pressure probably would change.
Pressure not change, but the diameter of the what you call the troposphere would.
Possibly. Let's just take out SPD. So here's another big controversy, and you may have read about this. How has the climate varied over the last 1,000 years, the last 10,000 years? And the reason this is important is a lot of people are saying that we are seeing unprecedented temperatures right now. These are the highest temperatures we've ever seen. A lot of people said that. Go ahead, please. Most historical climatologists have used this sort of a relationship for the last 1,000 years. This has been the more or less accepted trend in temperatures in the last 1,000 years, with a period beginning around 1300 AD, a very rather cool period known as the Middle Ice Age, preceded by a much warmer period known as the Medieval Warm Period, or the climate optimum of the Middle Ages. That climate optimum is the period in which Greenland was settled. It actually grew grapes in Greenland and in the British Isles in that time, but mysteriously they had to move back to the continent in about 1400 because it just got too darn cold. There has been a warming since about 1850, and some people say, well, that's greenhouse warming, and other people say, well, no, it's a recovery from the Little Ice Age. Well, maybe one or the other. Here's another chart that's it goes back a little bit farther. From a couple of journal articles. Back on the far left there, about 11,000 years ago, the temperature rising and coming out of the last glacial period. And this period that we're in right now, this interglacial, is called the Holocene. The Holocene maximum probably occurred about 5,000 years ago. It may have happened 7,000 years ago, but most paleoclimate people, most geologists agree that that was the warmest time of the Holocene. And there's generally been a cooling since that time. Now, there have been some abrupt short-term cool periods that you see there in the blue, and some other warm periods that you see in the red. But there's the Little Ice Age way over on the right, and the modern warming to the right of that, and the medieval warm period. So this is what most of the long-term climate historians say has happened in the last 11,000 years. Next, please. In 1998, Michael Mann, Raymond Bradley, and Malcolm Hughes published an article in Nature magazine that suggested that those previous works were incorrect, and that in actuality the temperatures looked like this. A more or less steady temperature from 1000 AD until about 1850, and then a rapid rise. And what they did is they tacked on the actual temperature readings at the end there to what is mostly a tree ring history prior to that. And this was used not long after, next please, in the U.S. National Assessment of Climate, without the error bars, just the trace itself. Now, some people noticed that this was shaped a little bit like a hockey stick, a long stick with a, whatever you call the thing at the end. And so this has come to be known as the hockey stick among climate people. This was, according to a lot of people, rushed onto the field of play, so to speak, and used without very much peer review by scientists. And in fact, rather belatedly, in the last couple of years, several scientists have published articles in refereed journals which suggest that this was done poorly and incorrectly. And I have a couple of examples, quick examples here. Next, please. Hans von Storch of Europe had analyzed the statistical methods that Mann and colleagues used, and this is a real busy graph, but But what you see there is around 1500, 1600, 1700, you see the decrease in temperature that would be associated with a little ice age, and then the much warmer temperatures around 1100, 1200, looking a lot more like the first graph I showed you, first two graphs, than the Michael Mann graph. Next, please. Stephen McIntyre, Ross McKittrick went through the programs that Mann and colleagues used and found some mathematical errors in their statistical program and suggested that the corrected version using the same data set actually looks like this with even warmer temperatures 600 years ago than what we're seeing today, suggesting that we're not indeed seeing unprecedented warm temperatures. This idea of unprecedented temperatures is one that people had latched onto and saying, we're seeing unprecedented temperatures at a time when CO2 is increasing, therefore the temperatures are the result of CO2. And if the temperatures are not unprecedented, then at least takes away part of that argument.
Doctor, how were those temperatures recorded 1,000 years ago? Or 1,500 years ago?
Yeah, seeing as how the thermometers were 300 years ago, that's pretty hard. That's a very good question. Thank you for asking it. There are a number of methods that are known as proxies. They are measured parameters that can give us some guidance about what climate was doing, and that includes tree rings, ice cores, sediments, even the tree lines, even the dens of pack rats would collect different things at different times. You can get an idea of what the vegetation is like in an area. It's a fuzzy picture, but using some of these what are called paleoclimate indicators, you can make the fuzzy picture a little less fuzzy. In ice cores and in sediments, you can look at different isotopes, oxygen isotopes, and other chemical compounds, and really intelligent people can make a lot of sense out of it. And that doesn't include me, but I take other people's word for it. Next, please. Let's just get going. So let's take a look at Oregon and see what's been happening here. Are we seeing unprecedented temperatures in Oregon, and what does the last 100 years or so look like? Oregon data, measured data, go back into roughly the mid-19th century. We have a few stations that go back that far. Most of them go back into the latter part of the 19th century. And so I'm going to show some of the better long-term stations. Go ahead, please. This is Ashland. And this is annual average temperature back to 1889. And there's a lot of jumping around, but some general trends. Now, in Ashland, the warmest year of the last 100 years occurred in 1992, but the warmest decade occurred in the 1930s. And you see, if you can just sort of imagine a smooth line connecting those, there's somewhat of a cyclical pattern to this. Next, please. Astoria, the warmest decade in the last 100 years was the 1930s. The warmest year was 1934. It got cooler and it's gotten warmer recently, but still the warmest period was in the 30s. Next, please. Cascadia, the Cascadia Foothills dated back to 1919. The warmest decade of the last 100 years was the 1930s. The warmest year was 1934. Next, please. Bend, back to 1902. The warmest decade was the 1930s. Sounds like a broken record. The warmest year is 1934. Next, please. Condon, northeastern Oregon, out in the wheat country. The warmest decade of the last 100 years was the 1930s. Warmest year was 1934. Next. Corvallis. Warmest decade was 1930s. The warmest year was 1939. Second warmest year was 1934. Now, I look at that and I'm really reminded of that Arctic temperature plot I showed you. And I'm going to show you a U.S. plot, and if you can kind of fuse this in your mind. See what you think. Next, please. Crater Lake, dated back to 1931. There was a gap there for World War II. The warmest decade was the 1930s. The warmest year was 1934. Next, please. Lakeview, the warmest year was 1934. I'm really not sure which one the warmest decade is. There really hasn't been much change since the 20s. Next, please. North Bend, warmest decade was the 30s. Warmest year was 1934. Next. Pilot Rock, same story. Next. Now there's the U.S. temperature. This is from the rural stations. Ignoring the urban stations, because climate scientists know that there are a lot of problems with urbanizations when it comes to assigning large-scale climate trends. So this is the United States annual average temperature. The warmest decade of the last 100 years was 1930s. The warmest year was 1934. Okay. However, when it comes to the global temperatures, we see a much different pattern. And this chart on the right, which shows us getting unprecedented temperatures in the last couple of decades, and this is the one when you hear, last year was the third warmest of the last 100 years, it comes from this chart, which is based on a variety of measurement sites worldwide. Many climate scientists believe that there are some very inappropriate and erroneous stations that are included in that. The United States has a very rich system, over 10,000 long-term stations, and a tremendously effective and powerful system for archiving the data. Most other countries don't. Next, however, we do see a few stations in Oregon which resemble that global trace and for which we are seeing unprecedented high temperatures. Forest Grove is one of them. Next. So is Portland. However, both of those are growing urban and, in one case, suburban areas. And therefore somewhat different in nature because land use change is pretty significant. Next. I believe that a primary cause of those unprecedented high temperatures at Forest Grove and Portland, and in fact in the global data set is this one that's identified on this EPA page. It's called the Urban Heat Island Effect. And what it says is, and it's been measured many times, that in and around the city center, because of land use change, human activities, asphalt, space heating, space cooling, cars and trucks and airports and so on, the temperatures are higher than they are in the rural areas. And if you have a city that's changing substantially, you're going to get an upward trend in temperatures that has nothing to do with global climate and everything to do with land use change. Next, please. Here's one example of that in action. Portland Airport in Corvallis. Corvallis is a rural station. Portland Airport used to be, but obviously it's a pretty busy place right now. And the trend, Portland is in the red, Corvallis is in the blue. This is annual temperature. And they started out pretty much in lockstep. And over the years, Portland has gotten warmer and warmer compared to Corvallis. It's true in places all over the country, all over the Northwest. Next, please. Here's Seattle and Long Beach. Back at the turn of the last century, they were very close together, but Seattle has grown, and as it has, the temperatures have gone up, and Long Beach has grown very little. Next, Bellingham and Cedar Lake. We can find examples like this all over the place. And some people try to correct for this. I think most climate people feel that the only way to really get a handle on true trends in climate is to use the rural stations and just ignore the urban stations and that's what's done for the One of the other things that we hear about a lot is how the growing season changes, and I believe the Portland State said something about that. Bend, which has certainly grown quite a bit in the last several decades, has seen a big increase in its growing season. I guess if you're a gardener, this is really good news. Instead of averaging about 30 days a year between frosts, it's now averaging more like 90. And that's a substantial increase. And people look at data like this and say, well, there's the proof that global warming is going on. Well, what I did is I took this station and I took two rural stations or small town stations nearby and I plotted them all together. And that's on the next graph. Palina and Sisters. Palina in the blue, Sisters in the orange. And they have changed, not at all. While Bend has gone up. To me, this suggests strong proof that the Bend station, which is near downtown, not far from Highway 97, is affected by land use change and not by large-scale climate change. So this is not a greenhouse issue, this is a land use issue. Not to say that it's not warmer in downtown Bend than it used to be, but it's not because of climate change, it's because of land use change. So if it's not humans and if it's not the greenhouse effect, are there other things that cause climate change, and what are those things? A geologist sent me this one. The geologists go for this really long-term stuff, and he said, you know, we've got these four orders of time. The first order up at the top is like on the billion-year scale. And this is the geometry of the solar system, the sun itself, and the atmosphere, the greenhouse atmosphere of the Earth. Second order, tens of millions of years, it's the movement of the continents, continental drift, and the oceans. Third order, on tens of thousands of years, the ice ages, the orbits, solar variability, and the ocean changes. And then the one that we know, that I know the most about, and we think about the most, the fourth order, the shorter decadal to century scale, it involves El Nino and volcanoes and the kinds of things that we can at least study with a little bit more authority, and it also includes the human intervention. By the way, we can go back one please, Chris. Down on the bottom, there's kind of a temperature scale, and if you can see up at the top on the first order, there's a temperature associated with it, or an effect associated with it, and the biggest effect is from the top one, the smallest effect is from the one at the bottom. So here are some examples of variability in some of these, and this is orbital variables. So this is on hundreds of thousands of years. You have increases and decreases in temperatures. These are oxygen isotopes, and they're basically a proxy for temperature. So up is warm and down is cool. So you see ice ages, really cold periods with the downward parts and warmer periods. And we're in one of the warmer periods right now, where the minus 6 is. Most of the long-term people say in the next 50 to 100,000 years, we're almost certain to be in a really, really cold period. It may happen a lot sooner than that. Here's one for about the last little over 1,000 years. Based on sunspots, and this is a real complicated, busy diagram, and I apologize for that. But the sunspot numbers, which are in the black line over on the right, are compared with temperatures from ice cores, and so the reds and the blues represent temperatures from Antarctic, and the green is Greenland. But basically, when sunspots increase, the temperature of the atmosphere increases, and when they decrease, like they did around 1700, there were virtually no sunspots and the temperatures went way, way down. So we know that the sun has an effect on temperatures, and it's not surprising. Next, please. This is a shorter period, the last 250 years, showing changes in the level of radiation coming from the sun, the irradiance in the blue, and matching it with average temperatures of the northern hemisphere, and again, not surprisingly, they match it very well. We have had a period in the last 75 years of a very active sun, and also, I think not coincidentally, some significant warming in the atmosphere. Next, please. Let's skip that one. That's more of the same. Anyway, the sun does a lot. Other factors that operate on shorter time scales, on the bottom, the El Nino Southern Oscillation, El Nino events in the red, and La Nina events in the blue. In the northwest, El Niños tend to give us mild winters and usually dry. La Nina is just the opposite. And then over longer time periods, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, with periods of about 25 years of mostly blue, mostly La Nina, and periods of about 25 years of mostly reds. Notice on the top chart, back in the 30s and early 40s, when we had very significant warming, we had La Nina events. We had cooling thereafter during that La Nina period, and again warming since the mid-70s, again dominated by El Nino. So on a short-term basis, I really believe that these are tremendously important locally, regionally, and globally. And then there are volcanoes. This is Mount Pinatubo. Volcanoes, by and large, especially if they're big and with large dust clouds, tend to cool temperatures, sometimes for extended periods of time. Okay, getting close to the end. There are some other things we really don't understand, but you know, we'd be happy to study them, and we need to study this a lot more. Climate science is not a done deal. We have a long way to go to really understand it. So let me just summarize, if you haven't figured out by now, my views on anthropogenic climate change in 50 words or less. Climate is not subject to precise definition. To say that there's an average climate is probably a misnomer, and it's really hard to measure. We don't understand a lot about the way climate interacts, the equations of motion, the movement of air and heat. We don't really understand how much natural variability there is, and that makes it really hard to predict future climates. Not that we shouldn't try, but it's pretty hard to do. Number three, by increasing CO2 in the atmosphere, we have probably had an effect on the climate. It may involve a general warming. It may involve a cooling. 25, 30 years ago, people thought it would. Maybe a combination of both. Some places warmer, some places cooler. All else being equal, an increase in CO2 would cause warming, but all else is not equal. There are a lot of variables that come into play. Number four, I believe that the present state of the climate primarily reflects natural causes, solar radiation, El Nino, PDO, orbital changes, and so on. And I really think that the effects of greenhouse gases is a relatively minor one. And number five, I believe that any warming that we may see in the next century will be modest and near or below the low end of the predictions from the models that I showed you. And it will be very, very difficult, if not impossible, to detect those changes in any location. So, bottom line is, when it comes to global warming, I'd say I'm a minimalist. I don't deny that people influence climate. I really believe, however, that natural variations, natural factors, are much bigger causes of climate change than human activities are. Thank you for your attention. That's an awful lot of information to try to absorb, but I'd certainly be glad to try to answer.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Taylor. Very, very interesting presentation. I'm a little remiss in not having fully introduced you, and I would like to do just as the... We do appreciate very much the information, especially from a meteorological or climatological basis. And I hope you can stay around for a few minutes to field some questions if you have.
I'm here.
Excellent.
Not going anywhere.
Okay, if you will. Let me just bring Dr. Taylor to the BA in Mathematics from the University of Santa Barbara and MS in Meteorology from the University of Utah. He's been at Oregon State since 1989 and has consulting business, or had one, in Santa Barbara, I believe. Mm-hmm. And we sure welcome you here. We thank you very much for the time you've given us and the great information that you presented. Mm-hmm. It'll take a while to sort through that.
Well, you have a disc with my entire presentation on it and my business card, so feel free to follow up with any questions you have.
And some extra excellent information. Our next speaker, Dr. Margo Thorney, comes to us from Washington, D.C. She's a senior vice president and chief economist with the American Council for Capital Formation and director of research for public policy think tank. Dr. Thorney also serves as managing director of the International Council for Capital Formation, a new think tank incorporated in Brussels. The ICCF is an affiliate of the American Council for Capital Formation. Dr. Thorney is an internationally recognized expert on tax, environmental, and competitiveness issues. She writes and lectures on tax and economic policy and is frequently quoted in publications such as the Financial Times, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and I'm going to let you pronounce the Sederich Zeitung. Is that close?
Very good.
Dr. Thorney has made presentations on the economic impact of climate change policy at forums sponsored by the ICCF, as well as groups such as the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, French Council of Economic Advisors, the International Chamber of Commerce in Paris, the European Commission, the American Chamber of Commerce in Brussels, the International Federation of Industrial Energy Consumers, and the Center for Global Energy Studies in London. Dr. Thorney has a long resume that I won't continue with. I think you get the idea very clearly. He has spent much time in studying the field that we're talking about today. So, without any further introduction, welcome.
Thank you so much, Chairman Anderson, members of the committee. I'm honored to be here and delighted to share with you some of the research that Economic and Council for Capital Formation has sponsored over the years on this very important issue, climate change. I have to apologize because I have a lovely PowerPoint presentation for you that I'm just somehow resistant to that. So I did copy it for you and I can email it to you if you would like. Let's see, so I'm really sorry about that. But I also have testimony which I hope to get from the record. The ACCF Center for Policy Research, just to give you a tiny bit more background, is a bipartisan nonprofit think tank based in Washington, D.C. And on our board of scholars are such notables as the new Nobel Prize winner Prescott from Arizona State University, Dale Jorgensen of Harvard, Alan Mash, Stanford University, and others. So we are very lucky to have folks like that helping us and guiding us along in our research and programs. And what I was hoping to talk to you about today, and hopefully there will be time for questions and answers, are some of the central themes of this climate change debate that I have noticed not only in the U.S. but abroad. First, to talk a bit about an important tool that social scientists have been using for some time to evaluate the impact of regulatory and environmental policies, and that's the use of cost-benefit analysis. And in the U.S., especially at the federal level, we have increasingly turned to trying to measure the costs and benefits of different regulations to see whether the costs are anywhere near the benefits. And, for example, John Graham, who's head of the OIRA in Washington, the chief regulatory organization in Washington, and who, by the way, is a former member of the Board of Scholars of the ACCR, has done a very fine job in bringing cost-benefit analysis more to the front and making it more of a tool in Washington in particular. Some of their work shows that the cost, for example, in terms of lives saved for, say, steering wheel regulation, adding steering wheels is like $100,000 per life saved. But for formaldehyde regulation, it's $72 billion. So, you know, there's a huge discrepancy, obviously, in the cost and benefits of different regulatory issues. But nonetheless, it's something that I think the Bush administration has tried to use as it evaluated the proper approach to deal with climate change policy, which is, of course, a very important policy. If you could take a look at the first slide, which we handed out to you, which is a look at the growth in carbon emissions from 1990 projected out to 2010. The chart shows that most of the emission growth is going to be in the developing countries, and that gray area is China, India, Brazil, Latin America, Indonesia, places, Africa, the developing world. Whereas the developed countries, as you can see from this chart, are an increasingly smaller share of projected increase in emissions. In the U.S., which is right now about 23% of total carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, is projected to shrink over the next 20, 30 years to 10 or 15%, and even less. So, you know, based on the fact that the growth in carbon emissions is going to be in the developing world, and based also on extensive economic modeling, the administration has taken another tact to deal with the potential threat of climate change. There's been a lot of modeling in the U.S. using macroeconomic models, which are designed to measure the short-term impact of a change in taxes or a change in regulations. They're designed to tell you what's going to happen if, let's say, you impose energy taxes over the next 10, 15, 20 years. What does that do to your capital stock? What does it do to the new investment? What does it do to employment and output? There are also general equilibrium models that are more appropriate for looking at things after you've had time to let the capital stock naturally turn over. So over a 30 or 40 year period, what is the impact of a change in, let's say, tax or environmental and have policies. And the administration had the benefit of examining various different model results, and that's slide number 2 in the little handout that you've got, which looks at the impact on the U.S. economy of trying to meet the Kyoto targets. And as you can see, there's a range of estimates that, for example, the one on the far left is the DOE, Energy Information Administration, model estimate of the impact on GDP levels in the U.S. in approximately 2010 if we were to try to meet the Kyoto target, which would have required a 7% reduction in CO2 by the year 2010, 7% off 1990 levels. And according to DOE, our Department of Energy, it would have reduced the level of GDP by about 4.2% in 2010, which would have, by 2010, that would probably be about $500 billion lost in GDP. In today's terms, it's about...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, to make sure we understand this, I want to ask what that baseline is. Is that what we would expect to have happen if this regulation is not in effect?
Precisely.
So it's not a 4.2% decrease from our current GDP, it's from what it would be in 2010 with or without the regulation.
Absent the regulation, exactly. The term they use is baseline forecast, so it's off the baseline forecast absent this regulation. And so there are other estimates shown here. Wharton Econometric Forecasting shows about a 3.2% loss in 2010-2012 per year. ABARE is the Australian Bureau of Resource Economics. They've done a lot of modeling, not only from Australia, but from the U.S. BRI and CRA is Charles River Associates, an internationally known consulting firm. Mann and Richels, Professor Mann at Stanford, and from on the very far right is the Clinton administration's forecast of what would happen to GDP if the Kyoto Protocol had been imposed. And that was during, the time that President Clinton and Vice President Gore were very actively supporting this proposal, and they used a model that was really not appropriate, and the assumptions were not exact, were not appropriate to come up with their conclusion that the economic impact was very small. But when members of Congress saw this table, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to look and see, the preponderance of different models using somewhat different technologies and different assumptions showed very significant cost to the U.S. economy. And when you realize that the U.S. is going to become an industrial country, so in general, will become an increasingly smaller share of the total increase in CO2 emissions, the cost versus the benefits just didn't add up. So I think that's the Bush administration had the benefit of a range of good models from credible scholars and consulting firms. They had decided that the cost of the targets and timetable approach simply didn't equal the benefits, because the reductions globally, and climate change is a global issue, not a local issue, the reductions just would not be enough. The benefits would be so small and the cost so great that they've chosen another approach. I want to also point out that the Kyoto targets are just the start of the series of ever-tightening targets, as our scientist, Dr. Taylor, just mentioned before. The goal of the environmental community and people like Prime Minister Tony Blair is in fact a very steep set of reductions. And the climate change, the targets and timetables proponents have suggested that we need an 80 to 90%. We in the industrial world need to reduce CO2 by 80 to 90% by 2050. In other words, phasing out the use of fossil fuels. No coal plants, no fossil fuels for transport or for households or for electricity generation. And so the target that the UK's Interdepartmental Analysis Group has proposed for some of the major developed countries for the US is an 80% reduction by 2050. For Canada, 75%. the United Kingdom 58%, the EU as a whole about 55%. So the end game is not the Kyoto target, the end game is much, much more draconian reductions in CO2 from those proponents in the environmental community who are supporting the targets and timetables approach. So that's one thing that people need to focus on. Kyoto is not enough. In fact, Clinton's climate policy advisor, Tim Wirth, suggested we need 10 Kyotos. So that's where they would like to see policies change. Well, as I said, you know, we've analyzed the case for the United States and concluded that the costs are very high. Well, what about for Oregon? Last year, the American Council for Capital Formation asked Charles Rivers Associates, the international consulting firm, to do an economic analysis of the impact of implementing the McCain-Lieberman legislation, which called for a reduction in CO2 to 2000 levels starting in the year 2010. We also asked them to assume that in the year 2020, states and the U.S. had to get on a trajectory to reduce emissions along the lines of the New England governor's proposal, which requires an 80% reduction in CO2 by 2050. So we had sort of a two-stage process, first looking at things from 2010 to 2020, and then beginning to get on a much tighter trajectory. And so in your little handouts, you have some of the highlights of the results for the state of Oregon. And by the way, these are available on our website, www.accf.org. We have about 18 individual states, two-page write-up on Oregon and 17 other states, plus the U.S. as a whole, plus an explanation of the model that was used by Charles Rivers and a comparison with some other results. So I invite you to download that off the climate change section of the ACCF website. But as you can see, some of the summary snapshot results of Oregon adopting the McCain-Lieberman proposal of trying to get down to 2,000 levels of emissions starting in 2010 means that household electricity prices would have to rise by about 8%, gasoline prices would have to rise by 24%, natural gas prices paid by industry would go up by about 54%, approximately 400 job losses by 2010, household income falling by about $750, and an annual decrease in GDP of about 0.6%. And not only that, state and federal tax.
I understand that number.
0.6%. It's in your little chart. About a 0.6% drop in gross state product and smaller state tax receipts. The low income and the elderly would bear a disproportionate burden because, of course, they spend more of their income to start with than do upper income people who are able to save, and they tend to spend relatively more on energy and electricity as a percent of their income. And by the year 2020, assuming that Oregon and industry was getting on the trajectory to reduce emissions very drastically, 80% below 1990 levels by 2010, of course, industry is retooling. Industry is moving out of Oregon, offshore probably, as you assume the whole U.S. is covered by this plan. You can see electricity prices are up by 12%, natural gas for industry up by 80%, household income is down by almost $3,000 a family, $1,400 per family, job losses are up to close to $3,000, and GDP is a very significant 3.2% less. Gross state product would be over 3% smaller because, of course, industry is moving out, there's less manufacturing, and so the impact gets stronger and stronger because we don't expect by 2020 there to be any magic bullets that let us substitute for fossil fuel for transportation.
Question. Thank you.
CHOP 2010 and Penny Penny. Electricity will go up only 12%. Why the natural gas, the industry going up almost 7 times higher?
Natural gas, of course, has many uses, not only for electricity production, but for all types of manufacturing. And so we expect, as the industry and other organizations try to reduce their use of fossil fuels, they're going to switch out coal and into natural gas, pushing up the demand for natural gas.
Are these based on the baseline figure again?
Exactly.
So these are the differences between what it would be without the regulation and what it would be with the regulation.
Precisely, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. I ask a question, going back just a moment. It intrigues me that certainly it looks like there's a major challenge economically. Why would the European Union
Well, there is one point of view that thinks that the European Union, because I spent a fair amount of time in Europe with our think tank based in Brussels, and I kind of pick up on what different sectors of policymakers and are saying, but there's one school of thought that says that Europe, and I've heard policymakers say, well, Europe doesn't lead in anything else, but at least we lead in environmental policy. We're leaders there. And so we really can't go backwards. We want to go forwards on this. And they also know that if the U.S. doesn't join them, they will be increasingly uncompetitive because we will continue to be able to produce goods and services with energy prices as we're all suffering now from higher gasoline prices, but at least we're not adding on large taxes to force energy use down. So they want to make us participate in curbing our emissions along the lines of the Kyoto Protocol so that we're dragged down the same as they're going to be dragged down. Now, interestingly, in the last 3 years, as the IPCF has been going to Europe and sharing with policymakers there, some of the analysis we've done on the economic impact of Kyoto and the tighter targets on Germany, UK, Netherlands, Spain, Italy, policymakers have begun to think twice about whether they really do want to go forward with this initiative. And that was pretty quick with the Kyoto Protocol and the tighter targets in the second commitment period. It was pretty clear at the COP10 meetings, the International Climate Change meetings in Buenos Aires in December, that people around the world are having second thoughts about the wisdom of trying to actually hit the Kyoto Protocol target, much less the tighter targets that people in Europe have been discussing for the post-2010 period. So I sense a change in opinion. And for example, the Italian environment minister was on a panel we hosted in Buenos Aires, and he just flatly said, we are not going to adopt targets for the post-2012 period. And you know, they clearly are aware that energy use and economic growth go hand in hand, and if you try to force down energy use to meet your Kyoto targets prematurely, you're going to have a negative impact on jobs and growth. And the Europeans right now, for example, Germany's employment is 12%, and in the average of the EU is 10%. Growth there averages about 1% a year compared to 3% or better here in the U.S. So sensible people are really thinking twice about how they want to proceed, and based on how they reacted to the Stability Pact, which was the pact that required countries to keep their budget deficits at 3% or less of GDP, they just now went in and changed that to make it easier and to make the targets not so binding, because countries like France, Germany, and Italy couldn't make those targets. So they're backing away from the Stability Pact that was put in place some years ago to try to contain inflation, and I feel certain they will back away from their Kyoto target. the EU is not on track to meet their emission reduction targets. They are projected right now by their own European Environmental Agency to be about 7.5% above their Kyoto target in the year 2010. They're not going to make their target, and they won't impose any penalties, even though they have statutory penalties for failing to meet the targets. Nobody's going to send money to Brussels because they failed to meet their emission targets. They just won't. So I'm sorry, that was a long answer.
Okay. The first protocol, the currently, how many members are joined in the
Well, there are a lot of members that have signed up, but not many of them have targets. You know, the EU15 and the additional 10 countries that joined the EU recently have targets under there, and they've signed up. Canada signed up, but they're already beginning to talk about how they can't meet their targets. So most of the countries that signed have no targets because the developing countries don't have any targets. It's just the 39, what they call NXD, the developed countries that have targets. And once Russia signed, due to apparent desire to get into the WTO, that may be a protocol. They have their 55% of emissions covered, so it went into effect. But I maintain it really doesn't mean anything because the countries won't make their targets clearly. I mean, that isn't me, it's the European Environmental Agency projecting it, and they won't impose penalties. So we need a better approach, another approach to climate change. And that's where I think the Bush administration has probably got it right. And that's why I attached to my testimony the Bush administration climate change program, which is spending our tax money to the tune of $5.8 billion this year on the study of climate science and issues of new technology. They're spending about $3 billion on new technologies this year. And I think the programs that really are going to pay off are more spending on technology with the hope that down the line there may be fossil hydrogen that can be produced without fossil fuels, so that we may have transport based on hydrogen or other types of energy. Carbon sequestration. We could sequester the carbon in a safe way, then we could continue to use the fossil fuels. But in addition to more money on technology, a global effort on that, and a global effort to understand climate science, there is another idea, which is embodied in a paper by Dr. Montgomery of Charles Rivers Associates that was published last summer by the American Enterprise Institute. And it correlates the growth of economic freedom as defined by the Fraser Institute or the Wall Street Journal's Index of Economic Freedom. It correlates the growth in economic freedom with economic growth and with reductions in energy intensity per dollar of output. And this little slide in your handout, and it's figure 4 in my testimony, shows the correlation for, and there are actually, I think, 120 or so countries, but we couldn't, it's just been a black mass if we put 120 dots in. But you can see, for example, up at the top, Russia is very, very energy intensive. They're using approximately, and I apologize, the key didn't show up on this slide, but the key does show up in the testimony. It's BTUs per dollar of output. And Russia uses 77,000 BTUs per dollar to produce a dollar of output. China uses about 36,000 BTUs to produce a dollar of output. They too are not very efficient in terms of energy. India uses about 25,000 BTUs per dollar of output, whereas the U.S., down near the bottom right-hand corner, is using only about 17,000 BTUs to produce a dollar of output. And Japan, I apologize, they're not showing up there, is even less than the U.S. So the point of David Montgomery's analysis is that countries that have high degree of economic freedom tend to grow faster, they tend to pull through their capital stock quicker, and they are much more energy efficient than countries that are characterized by high trade barriers, subsidies for state-run enterprises, lack of protection for intellectual property rights, a lot of corruption at the government level, lack of protection for contract law, lack of investment in infrastructure, and so forth. So economic freedom, if we can help propagate that idea globally, economic growth will follow, and with it, a reduction in energy intensity. We have a new book on our ICCF Global website that goes into discusses this extensively, and I encourage you to download that. It's www.iccfglobal.org. To wrap up, the bottom line is that I think countries probably, in terms of cost effectiveness, the best way to address climate change policy is to focus on removing barriers to economic growth in the developing world to help them get access to the energy they need to grow, and do that promoting economic freedom and market reforms. We need more R&D, more technology, and of course the administration is putting money into that, as are many countries around the globe. Substantial resources are going into that. We need to develop sequestration. We need to encourage the use of nuclear power for electricity. Expand bilateral cooperation, which the administration is trying to do with developing countries, and promote a truly global solution to climate change. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bruni. Any questions?
You were going to put out a question. That's fine.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Our final speaker today is Christopher Horner. Christopher is a practicing attorney in Washington, D.C., focusing on issues of treaties, international trade, energy, and environment. Also serves as senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington and policy counsel for the European Enterprise Institute in Brussels, Belgium. Horner has written numerous topics in publications ranging from Law Review, the Legal Industrial Trade Journal, to print and online opinion papers. He's testified before the United States Senate Committees on Foreign Relations and Environment and Public Works. Last month, he gave his fourth address in the European Parliament on this issue, and later this month, addressing policymakers in Rome and Madrid. Horner has several hundred appearances each on both radio and television in the United States, as well as numerous programs in Europe, Canada, and Australia. Chris, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify and speak to you today about the issue of the political realities of the Kyoto Protocol, and I will be addressing in depth some of your questions, particularly about Kyoto participation in Europe. I've said this before, power corrupts and PowerPoint corrupts absolutely, so I've decided to forego having them try to move over and go through about 12 slides. I've handed them out instead, and I will refer to them. I'm not tracking them precisely, but they do thematically track what I'm going to say. So, a few things. Clarify a couple of points regarding what George was saying. House temperatures were measured way back when. Mr. Fahrenheit invented his thermometer in the Little Ice Age, which was unfortunate, I suppose. In fact, near the tail end of the Little Ice Age. And so you have a very convenient chart that's thrown around showing that the baseline is cool, and then suddenly there was a warming. In fact, this is what happens when ice and cooling periods end, is by definition, you get a warming. So we have to go back. You go up and switch from proxies to actual temperature measurements, and you saw the hockey stick. The media loves record this, record that. Okay, we talk about record oil prices, which is true, if history began 20 years ago. But we know it didn't. Prices were $90 a barrel in the early 80s if we adjust for inflation, which you have to. So we hear about the dollar at a record low against the European currency, which is true, if U.S. monetary history began 6 years ago, which it did not. The U.S. dollar has been much lower against the basket of principal European currencies. It's just the way things are reported. You hear about record temperatures, and you saw how true that is. Margot mentioned the Clinton team. I have a slide, it's on my computer, I can show you. After they left office, the relevant Clinton administration officials admitted Kyoto's costs. So the model that was used was admitted, in essence, inappropriate afterwards. Now, you cited, Mr. Chairman, that largely one side is often presented, but quite often claims are reported that aren't even one side. They would be laughably incorrect if the consequences weren't so serious. And I'm going to say things that will likely surprise you. For example, the U.S. signed the Kyoto Protocol in November 1998. Okay? The U.S. never unsigned Kyoto. The U.S. never withdrew from Kyoto. The U.S. never withdrew from the Kyoto process. We still send, typically, the largest delegation of any nation to the talks. So, you hear sometimes in the same story, often in the same wording, the Kyoto Protocol, from which President Bush withdrew the U.S. in 2001, and then they'll talk about the U.S. negotiating team, without embarrassment. That's just lazy reporting. The U.S. did declare a stalemate in talks in November 2000. Governor of Texas' name, okay. November 2000, it was in The Hague. Some of you may have been there. I was. I will provide to anyone interested my press clippings revealing that until the occupant of the White House changed, the Earth Times, the New York Times, and even the BBC attributed the breakdown in the talks to Europe. This was during the Florida recount, so you know who the president was not. Only when the recount went the wrong way, apparently, was blame shifted to the U.S. and its new president for, on March 14, 2001, reaffirming his predecessor's position. Inartfully, but all he did was reaffirm that we would not submit the Kyoto Protocol for ratification. You can look at the slide number 2 on the first page showing that the U.S. political leader's position has remained consistent on Kyoto from the beginning. Again, despite reckless reporting to the contrary, none of what I just discussed is specifically what you hear. Now, Kyoto was a global treaty also, as claimed, only if it was no longer had meaning. Your question is how many countries participate? 38 countries, as agreed, of 191 countries are covered or committed to reduce or limit their greenhouse gas emissions to some level, particular to each one. The U.S.'s reduction is 7% below 1990. 1990 was an awful lot of economic growth here. That's something like, it's going to be 30% below where we are projected to be. These 38 covered nations include, in addition to the U.S., fellow industrial titans Liechtenstein, Iceland, Monaco, Latvia, Belgium, Bulgaria, Slovakia, and so on. True, 120 countries have ratified Kyoto. Ratifying a treaty is a free ride if you are in no way bound, and at worst can expect wealth transfers. The 150 nations exempted by Kyoto include tiny China, Mexico, South Korea, India, Brazil, Indonesia, and other big players on the world economic and environmental stages. China has alternately said that it will never agree to Kyoto's ratchets, or that it will consider the idea in 50 years. Last month, South Korea's environment minister announced that his country, as with China, India, and Brazil, could never comply with actual emission cuts, like those designed for others in Kyoto, and I cite those. Depending on your measurement, market exchange rates, or purchase power parity, China is the world's second largest economy, and indisputably the second largest emitter of greenhouse gases, projected to be the largest emitter within 15 years. In fact, although exempt, China and India together will soon produce over half of the world's man-made emissions. Another exempt, so-called lesser developed economy, South Korea, the world's 11th largest economy and 9th largest emitter. Also exempt are numerous among the 25 largest economies, including numbers 10, 12, and 15. This is absurd, if only because the so-called low-hanging fruit, which the UN Environment Program head Klaus Hofer claimed Kyoto would harvest, is not found in the cleaner, wealthier industrial countries. It is found, if you refer to slide, I'm sorry, this is not very clear, but slide 4 on the second page is from a new book by the Institute for Economic Affairs, and they show on the left, you really can't derive anything from this, and I'm sorry, it's poor photocopying equipment, but the gains to be made if you seek to make gains in greenhouse gas emissions are made in the exempt countries. China and India are the two left dark graphs, and well above them are what this represents is actual emissions with installed technology and new technology where you would be. The next two bars are the U.S. actual emissions and what you would emit from newly installed technology, and you'll see that when I show you the better copy of the slide, that in the U.S. and Japan, we're near technological, using current available technology, near or optimum. I mean, China and India have tremendous low-hanging fruit gains to be had. So exempting the countries where the low-hanging fruit is doesn't make any sense if your goal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and avoid social consequences. Now, because most of the world is exempt, Kyoto covers even far less of the emissions projected in just a few short years. Exempt countries are expected to emit 75% of greenhouse gases by 2050 and near 90% by 2100. This is what passes for a global treaty. More relevant, Kyoto covers, not reduces in some perfect treaty world, but covers countries responsible for well less than 1% of total annual CO2 production, given that manned CO2 production is marginal. As George alluded, most of it's water vapor and most of the greenhouse gases totaled on that. The global rejection of Kyoto's cuts matters, particularly to policymakers like yourselves. Kyoto's proponents acknowledge that even if fully complied with and perfectly functioning, and assuming all of Kyoto's scientific and now thoroughly discredited economic and emission scenarios, Kyoto would not have a detectable impact on climate. Instead, it is, quote, the first of 30 steps. Now, that quote is from the father of modern global warming theory, Dr. James Hansen, who now predicts a half a degree temperature increase. But he still says we need 30 Kyotos to address it. That is, Kyoto or Kyoto-like rationing could not pass a cost-benefit test because it admittedly offers only cost and no benefit. While Kyoto would then include most, not even all, of Europe, and here are the interesting slides, and less than a dozen others. Hardly anyone covered is a Biden. This may be hard to imagine, given the rhetoric, remarkable rhetoric, aimed at the U.S., including from within. Europe continues to rhetorically claim, as Dr. Poning alluded, to the mantle of leadership on Kyoto. However, according to the latest submissions by key EU-15 countries, they have the EU-15 follow-up, to the European Environment Agency, projected Kyoto violations include the following. Portugal, over by 77%. Greece, by 51%. Spain, over by 61%. Italy, either 13 or 23%, depending on which document you look at. Ireland, over by 41%. Luxembourg, over by 31%. Finland, by 27%. Denmark, by 26%. French emissions are going to be 19% over under the laws they put in place. Austria, 18% over. Belgium, 16% over. And the Netherlands, 10% over. This isn't their 10% over now, and they expect to reduce. They're projecting violation of 77 to 10% among these countries by 2010. That is, they officially admit that after 7 years pursuing, albeit half-heartedly, with great economic effect, though, economy-friendly policies aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions, barring massive intervention in the form of even further increased car, road, and fuel taxes, they will, most of the European countries will be wildly in violation of their Kyoto promises. They are counting on the UK to drag them all over their bubble commitment by shifting entirely from gas to coal to gas. The dash to gas, prompted by Margaret Thatcher, was going to bring them all to bubble, all under the 8% reduction. It doesn't appear that's the case. And the political impact of this, where the 77% older Portuguese are now going to be responsible individually as opposed to as part of a bubble, those are starting to be felt. What Dr. Warren just testified to about what's going on in Brussels is true, and I'll address that. And I also cite the proposal to dramatically increase road, car, and fuel taxes and location numbers. It's a document that's just out in January. So, Europe's climate superiority and leadership are found in breaking a promise that the U.S. and 150 others are too realistic to make. The resulting political problems, as I said, have done this again. They did not, when the Commission met last month, they did not propose new emissions targets. That sort of flew under the radar. Then the Environment Council met, which is frankly meaningless as a policy matter, and they said we should go further, and that was reported. It doesn't matter. These are important facts in the debate dominated by rhetoric and in which state and federal policymakers are constantly scolded for allowing the U.S. to be so grossly out of step with the rest of the world, to purportedly be acting alone with 150 others, by refusing to make an unrealistic promise, instead insisting on a more practical focus. It's more critical given the current state of play, negotiations in Buenos Aires, next month in Bonn, COP 10 in Nice, focus on post-2012. Kyoto is a five-year treaty, 2008 to 2012. Now they're looking at what happens after that. Italy already stepped forward in Buenos Aires and said, we're not looking at second round commitments. Okay? It is not time to break a bigger promise, not to be broken small. We're going to look at this practically. And they got up on the stage very courageously with the U.S. and India and China, and there's now a Pacific worldview. It's not going to happen. And as Margo alluded, this is largely a matter of face in Europe. How do you got it? Can't be Bush's idea, I promise you that. How do they do it? Now, certain forces in Europe are certain forces, as I alluded. In essence, now that they've broken one promise, it's time to break a new barrier. Fortunately, although you'd never know that from reading press accounts, that position is now created into the minority in the halls of the European Union, if not within the environmental pressure groups. Still, this comes to you, legislators are urged, we must do something. This is something, therefore we must do it. Right? To accept these arguments, you inherently accept that you must in fact do everything that the Rio and Kyoto prescriptions set forth. A 60 to 80% reduction in our greenhouse gas emissions. Why do something with all cost and no benefit unless you're doing the whole nine yards? This, of course, would only matter if A, Europe et al. Did the same, which clearly they are not, by their own admission, and B, were natural greenhouse gas emissions and climate stable, which of course they are not. Gesture politics such as Kyoto or less compel one to immediately commit to the entire program because the sole basis for regulating or otherwise addressing greenhouse gases is the theory of catastrophic mandate global warming. If you accept that premise, you have to accept a regime that will have a detectable impact. Kyoto doesn't. Admit it. If you must do something, anything short of Kyoto and yesterday, with an agreement to move the phase two immediately and a promise to go all the way, sounds less than sincere. This is the basis of statements, and I suggest we go to the bottom of page four. This is the basis of statements such as Kyoto is, quote, the first component of an authentic global governance. And Jacques Chirac and his COP6 in The Hague opening remarks. And Kyoto is merely, quote, a peanut in the larger agenda. That's Yoko Waller-Hunter, the UNFCCC's executive secretary. Other statements from our friends in Europe are equally illuminating when taken in the context of their increasing failure to keep up with the U.S. and others in Canada. This is about international relations, I quote. This is about economy, about trying to create a level playing field for big businesses throughout the world. You have to understand what's at stake and why it's serious. That is the irrepressible, inimitable, and priceless now Vice President of the European Commission, Margot Wallström, letting a little too much out of the bag. Still, why do certain U.S. agriculture, industry, and even coal-burning utility interests demand greenhouse gas regulatory programs? If, of course, only those that would do nothing, but provide them with rent. As George Bernard Shaw eloquently put it, if you're going to rob Peter to pay Paul, you can always count on the support of Paul. Speaking of which, Oregon is familiar with an old company and friend of mine, Enron, which happened to be the primary driver behind Kyoto, etc., in the U.S. before their other schemes caught up to them. I have a wonderful memo, what I did in Kyoto, with me, if you'd like to see it. Saying this treaty will be good for Enron stock, 3! This is exactly what we've been lobbying for. It was August 4th, 1997, Oval Office meeting with President Clinton, Vice President Al Gore, Ken Lay, and then Sir John Brown's VP, dictating what should be in a treaty, also revealed in Enron memo that Robert Novak has written about. And as the subsequent memo would be opening up, they're asking for a natural gas pipeline, Portland General, a lot of windmills, world's largest company, half share in the world's largest solar company. If they got rid of coal, space on that gas pipeline would be very expensive and maybe very rich. It sounds consistent with other Enron teams and plus. Others, including coal burners with old facilities, have rushed to fill the void for advocacy of state created climate wealth for select businesses. Even the seemingly benign near sequestration programs are not just infrastructure programs. They build a corporate lobbying constituency from mandatory caps, Kyoto by any name. It's not harmless pork, but an incentive for constituencies to later demand value be added by rationing CO2. Credits are worthless unless someone will find them. Few will voluntarily trade wealth for valueless hot air certificates. Climate exchange activity is what it is for the very simple reason. A lot of sellers lined up around the corner and merely the odd speculator lining up to buy, just in case. Somehow government signs value to these credits. Clearly, even these seemingly cheap and virtuous ideas do not get one out of the political issue. It is not tenable to assure the public that one is undecided on capital punishment as you construct the gallows in the town square. Same is true for CO2 infrastructure. The question facing you and many state lawmakers today remains whether you want to secure a poor world, or even a vastly poor world with Kyoto and its next steps, still with uncertain weather. We should all bear in mind the offerings of sober economists, even the great John Maynard Keynes of 100 years ago, when he was an award-winning scholar in England. He wrote a paper pointing to making this very point. The immorality of asking present generations to pay for a speculative, momentary, and undetectable benefit. Here, a brief and minor delay of a small temperature, 6 years. For future generations, through history, this proven will be even richer and more technologically advanced and adaptable than our own. Climate's always changed and always grown. Man's always adapted. Wealthiest societies have always adapted best. The response, therefore, is not to make any societies poorer, but to enhance wealth creation. You don't achieve this through managing energy. Instead, for those members sincerely concerned about man's possible influence on the climate, no regret policies make the most sense. I've enumerated some here. Remove regulatory barriers to innovation. Opposition to nuclear power and dams is not consistent with accepting the climate alarmism. This is not, as Tony Blair likes to say, the greatest threat facing mankind, except apparently for all the others. You cannot use nuclear power to abate the greatest threat facing mankind. Now dams are targeted. You can't use for CDN. You cannot get credits by building nuclear power plants in the so-called developing world. It's largely isn't. We need power to create sanitation and wealth and get themselves out of their situation and burn cleaner. Nuclear power is, according to Kyoto's own terms, apparently a greater threat than carbon dioxide, which is purportedly the greatest threat facing mankind. In Buenos Aires, the attempt continued, and Oregon should appreciate this, the attempt continued to prohibit hydroelectric power from being a way that you can get credits to abate the greatest threat facing mankind. Okay? And also monocultural trees, that is precisely what you would be accustomed to think they are in this day and age, trees that were only raised around their own kind. That is, like a new dirty word, farming trees, should not be permitted to abate for sink credit to abate carbon dioxide, which is purportedly the greatest threat facing mankind. So it's positions like this which tend to add an element of unseriousness to the debate. And should cause, before you put one person out of the job, be it George Taylor for the Crown or disagreeing with the New York Times or anybody else, look at these issues. There are other slides I have. There's a history of the EU. I don't want to go over the time. Speaking quickly. So I'll just point out what the EU's done throughout the course of these negotiations. Remember who we're dealing with, and I say this is someone who works part-time in Europe with Europeans. Originally, the EU accepted, in order to get us to agree, they accepted sinks, trees, okay? Shall be used, not may, not might, not may, not to some extent, shall be used by parties to meet their commitments. Then once we agreed, they fought the use of sinks to any appreciable degree, and in fact, the reason they, I'll stress, Clinton administration left the table in November 2000 was because the EU, watching the Florida recount every night on BBC, thought they had a very desperate team, and they thought they could get away with everything. And they said, we'll offer an 80% discount rate, which is, if you identify sinks, you get 20% of the credit. And the U.S. said, we can't comply. It's not economically feasible for us to do this, and the Clinton board team walked away. So the EU said, sinks shall be used, and then said, but not good. Then they agreed to much full use of sinks and bond, despite their earlier position being, sinks violate the environmental integrity of the agreement. Then they offered the one with Russia and China to get these on board. I'm sorry. By last year, about 2 months ago, when Kyoto went into effect, the EU was bragging of both its sink sequestration ability and cap and trade as wonderful attributes of their climate management system. They fought the inclusion of cap and trade, which was raised earlier, in Kyoto. Then they sought to block how much a country could employ in the bond talks, and then Marrakesh. And then by the time Kyoto went into effect in February, the EU embraced the cap and trade system as their own grand achievement. It is reasonable to expect similar growth, as we might say, as regards performing Kyoto's failed targets and timetables approach. Briefly addressing that we must do something, we're doing a lot. We're spending more than the EU and Japan combined on climate science. We spend, as you look, the government spends more money to climate research and atmospheric study than the National Cancer Institute. It's not like we're taking it seriously, it's a serious issue. It's just the idea of strangling an economy in the face of a speculative threat. We don't kind of understand it. It's not a very wise idea. And then, of course, we are the world's leading installed producer of renewable energy. So, again, this always comes open a few eyes, as does the last slide, which I strongly encourage you to look at. Our hottest decade also happened to coincide, not sort of, not kind of, but completely and entirely, with Russia closing and failing to maintain many of its cold weather measuring stations. And you'll see a dramatic pop in the surface temperature, not the atmospheric temperature, the surface temperature in 1990 when there were, of course, some political happenings over in Russia and tensions were elsewhere. The number of measuring stations went down dramatically. The temperature, as it is measured by numerous surface measuring stations, all maintained, if they are, by different people under different systems with different budget priorities, the temperature suddenly shot up. I suggest maybe the surface temperature, as George alluded, is not the best place to look for climate indicators. It's an atmospheric theory. It always has been and always will be. Measure the atmosphere. And we're spending an awful lot of money to do that. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. I think what I'd like to do is bring all of you up and maybe turn you around to the panel here. Have any questions that you'd like?
I have numerous questions.
Okay. And I would like to let the audience also ask questions. So let's have the committee ask first.
Thank you. I have to, since Chris was last, I'd like to start with Matan, if I may. One of the things I think you said, and I'm not sure I heard it, was that the main reason, or maybe perhaps the only reason to be interested in these kinds of issues, was to deal with global warming issues. I'm wondering if, in the process of thinking about these issues, if you have considered, in addition, our balance of trade issues, especially with the fact that we're importing large amounts of oil from other places, and also the potential for having difficulty with supply in the future, as additional reasons why it might be that you might want to have some kind of a policy around these issues. I'm not suggesting a particular policy, but why would I be thinking about this in addition to global warming as an issue? Mm-hmm.
The sole reason to create a greenhouse gas regulatory regime is to put the greenhouse warming there. And I think that's an absolute statement. Are there other reasons to be concerned about security of supply? Absolutely. I don't think our reserves are, I think if we're committed to get it, then our reserves are likely sufficient that Bjorn Lomborg, the Dane, wrote the Skeptical Environmentalist, is a great statement. We exited the Stone Age not because we ran out of stones. Similarly, we're going to exit the fossil fuel age not because we ran out of fossil fuels. We have an awful lot of both. There are ways to use coal that we didn't use before 50 years ago. Security of supply is a concern for Eastern Europe and the United States. Eastern Europe relying on Russian gas, and they've always had to look east for the last 90 years with some trepidation. That's one of their major concerns. It's one of ours because of the Arab state issue. But it's not tied to the climate threat.
Sure. I have a question, so just go ahead and ask them. Thank you. To the ACFR, the Margot Thorne, I'm interested in understanding these models that you use, and I'm wondering if any of these models include the issue of the feedback that's involved in, or the generation of jobs that's involved when you go through processes that are designed to result in reduced carbon emissions.
That's a real good question. In particular, the modeling done by WECO, which is the second one shown in that little chart in my handout, did include the possible creation of new jobs as people try to move into renewable technologies. And I suspect that in other macro models and the general equilibrium models also have some additional jobs being created in the non-fossil fuel sectors. But even when you take those into account, the fact that industry and households and the transport sector are having to meet very quick targets for substantially reducing their energy use and their fossil fuel use, an industry's capital stock becomes obsolete when the price of energy rises real quickly in order to force down energy use, that is enough of a drag on the economy that it offsets the jobs that would be created in alternative energy sectors. And in fact, the WEFA analysis concluded that the Kyoto Protocol would reduce U.S. employment by about 3 million jobs relative to the baseline, and that was still taking account of some new jobs coming in through renewables and alternative fuels.
Thank you. Your explanation or your concern has to do with the issue of the rapid obsolescence of capital goods, or are you thinking of some other issue?
Well, there are many issues. Production processes become less efficient when the capital stock becomes obsolete, and it was built to operate with energy prices of a certain level. We tend to see movement of industry offshore. We're already seeing that. But Mann and Alan Mann and Rich Richards did a study for the ACCF about 5 or 6 years ago that showed Kyoto Protocol would cause about 15% of the energy intensive sector in the U.S. to move offshore by the year 2015. So we lose our competitiveness if we sharply raise energy prices to force down energy use. And that's what our study showed for the European Union, and we analyzed 5 countries over there. They too lose industry. It moves offshore even quicker than it already is.
Okay. That's very helpful. And then I have a question for each of the panelists. I understand that your participation here today was not paid for by Oregon. I'm interested in really several questions that are related to that. Would you inform the committee what your primary sources of funding are, and how it was that you happened to be able to travel here and appear here today? That's basically a question for all of you. I understand that several of your event organizations are 501c3s. If that's not the case, would you also let us know that, so that we can use that information as well. I should say, as a preface to that, I did look on the websites for ALEC and ACCF, and I did get a substantial amount of information, but I was not able to get this information.
Good question. ALEC is 501c3. We are made up of 2,400 state legislators who pay individual dues to join ALEC. We also are made up of approximately 325 to 350 private sector members, meaning corporations. We do not take tax dollars. These corporations, and let me explain why they even join ALEC, why join 501c3. There are several state organizations out there for state legislators to belong to, NCFL, CSB, et cetera. We are the only organization that offers a place for everyone to sit down and hash out policy. We are bipartisan. Mm-hmm. And of that makeup, I would say we are probably 60-40 Republican versus Democrat, sometimes 70-30. I don't have those exact figures because we still have everybody joining after these new elections. So we get to witness at our table the great debate between the R's and the B's on policy. On the other side of the table, we have the private sector members. So much like the United States operates in a free market, and we get to listen to debates between the different industries, the same thing happens at our table. And we get to hear representatives from coal, from oil, from from nuclear, from farmers, from farming industry, to all of them. And each of them weigh in with their individual perspectives. And boy, if you thought the D versus R debate was something, you ought to see the battle going on amongst these guys. And so we continue and we develop policy, both model legislation and white papers, after everybody has voted on a position. And generally, we do not get involved in social issues. We look at economic issues, and we take that Jeffersonian free market approach to it. Once the policy has been voted upon at a task force, we have 9 task forces that are broken up. It then goes up to our national board, which is also made up of state legislators and of private sector members. And if they also pass it, then it becomes our policy. And it's my job as the director of legislation and policy to go out to the different states and speak to those policies. But it is a member-driven organization.
Okay. And a clarification question. Could you tell us what proportion of your budget is paid for by your 2,400 state legislative members versus your 325?
Yeah, the larger portion is paid by the corporate sector, the private sector members.
80%, 90%?
I don't have that figure. Probably in the 80% range. The legislators, I think, pay something, I can't, like their dues are covered 2-year term, is probably something like $100 or something like that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I paid for him to get here.
Alec paid for my airfare and I ate my own money.
Wonderful. And how is your 501c3 supported?
It annually breaks down just by happenstance at about a third each time. A third individual, about $5 checks, and wealthy individuals, a third foundation, and a third corporate.
And can we get a list of bills up here?
We want to get a list under IRS rules by phone for the 990.
Could you provide it for us?
If you'd like. Okay.
Thank you. That would be great.
The American Council for Capital Formation is a 501c6 and a 501c3, so it's a policy research of the c3. We have about 140 private sector companies and individuals. We have 35 to 40 trade association members, ranging from the Securities Industries Association, the American Benefits Council, the American Petroleum Institute, to provide the list of all of those. We have no government funding, and our list of members is available in our annual report, which I can send you. I don't know if it's on our website or not.
I would appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Well, in my case, I'm here in my professor of state climatology, so basically already is paying my salary today. I paid my own transportation costs, so I really didn't get reimbursed by anybody. So. And by the way, I haven't had a raise in about 3 years. This is the appropriate time to
that. You're caught in the same bind that the faculty members at all of the higher education institutions are caught in right now.
Whatever it was a complaint, I just figured you'd draw a laugh. So
thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Good timing.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, that's both of my questions.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Horno. Thank you for your presentation. My question is the security protocol. And this organization may countries belong, and some of them out, some of them in. It is not economically feasible, and to keep the agreement of Kyoto, and it's very costly to the state and the country. But at the same time, sometimes it makes sense that they might not enforce what they agreed upon, but at least send a strong message. And information, education around the world, maybe what they are doing might be just the effect of 1% of the world global that the gas issue, but at the same time, 1% could continue to increase to the other countries, and eventually, maybe 10, 20 years later, if every country belongs to this protocol, they might have some effects on the world, the global warming issues. So I'm not saying that belonging to Kyoto Protocol is the best at this time, but there should be some merit we should discuss. Then can you respond to that?
Yeah. It's
between population, number of countries, or GDP. For the current period of 2008 to 2012, it's more fair to say fewer in most of them. You can say there's sort of a silly argument being made, you're the one who caused the problem, which they claim is imminent, so it's not acceptable for most people to be out. I'm sorry. So you have to act first. In fact, as a policy matter, that's what I'm assuming. You have to go where you can make an impact first, and that would be tech transfer. If you believe this is a problem, you go for tech transfer where it's serious. Now, the good news is, what you just cited is an acknowledgement of the Kyoto Protocol that, in fact, a failure to grow economically is a greater threat to mankind than the threat of catastrophic global warming. And at least 191 countries agree with this. Because even Europe accepts the fact that most of the world is exempt because it would be very dangerous if they were not to grow economically. So I actually welcome that admission. Finally, sending the signal is great, but you know what? We've had our withdrawal from, which wasn't, Kyoto cited as a reason that EU would not cooperate on Iraq, still selling night vision goggles and things. I think Kyoto specifically cited green policy discussions there. As, in fact, Tony Blair had put before him about 6 weeks ago in his weekly committee briefing a demand that they get something for Iraq via the International Criminal Court or Kyoto. So we've gotten to the point where we're not talking about sending signals. This fairly irresponsible approach of certain foreign policymakers to use Kyoto as an excuse for various actions means this has gone beyond symbolism and sending signals to something where we need a reality check, a check on this trajectory, an acknowledgement of the threat, which is, you know, where we stand on state climatologists, and we can stop calling the sort of Noah's Ark that the UN trusts to put together. Two from Micronesia, two from Papua New Guinea, two from places where they really don't have a climate change budget in order to elevate them to work with the climatologists. Of course, they'll support the process. Let's have a sincere scientific debate, and none of this drowning out of politicians, policies, countries, or policymakers on the basis of our so-called withdrawal from Kyoto. So it's moved beyond symbolism, unfortunately. What I'm saying is let's have a return to a realistic debate both on science and policy and everything else. Thank you.
I wanted just to weigh in on that, on that very good question. If you take a look at my testimony, there's a figure 3 in there that looks at the comparison between the European Union and the U.S. in terms of how we've reduced energy intensity over the last 15 years. And if you look at that figure, you can see that from 1992 to 2001, the U.S. reduced energy intensity at a much faster rate, double the rate of the European Union has reduced their energy intensity. And reducing energy intensity, if we could do that globally in China and India and places as they go, of course, in the U.S. and the developing countries, that would allow us to both grow and hopefully in time begin reducing CO2 emissions if the science indicates that we must do that. It will also buy time to develop the technologies that will enable us to move away. But the reason that Europe is reducing their energy intensity so much slower than the U.S. is that they're growing so slowly, on average maybe 1% a year versus 3% faster, 3% or more in the U.S. So economic growth is a key component of trying to move into more energy efficient production processes as well as
quick follow-up. I'm sorry I forgot this, but there's a particular bone that I have with the role Kyoto now plays in international negotiations. It's often cited, and we can bring numerous examples, I have read them up, of how Kyoto was cited as how the United States squandered post 9/11 goodwill by withdrawing from Kyoto. Well, look, anybody who deals with these issues knows you're going to do this, okay? So that's really that's how the second. We all operate on the same, most of us operate on the same time. On March 14, 2001, and September 11, 2001, which came first. Right? So you can't say that we had universal goodwill for the U.S., and then they withdrew from Kyoto 9 months before. So it doesn't work that way. It's dishonestly used as an excuse for most any anti-American claim or actually foreign policy position we can make, and that's very unfortunate.
I'd like to just sort of bring this back home for you. What's happening to the states is that there are many companies with U.S. interests, and there are many European companies with U.S. interests. The U.S. companies have European interests. And with the changes in the EU and using the Kyoto Protocol and some of the international environmental treaties or rules that have been put into the EU, what's happening to you as state legislators is that these companies, and or I would argue special interest groups, other environmental organizations who receive donations through your foundations from shareholders who hold stock in these companies, come to you and say, we want a climate change regime. Why, as I mentioned before, they make some money on this. The question before you is, what is it that you're trying to address? If it is indeed climate change and you are concerned about the environment, Oregon has a wonderful natural resources base. Your energy comes primarily from three sources. You've got hydropower, as I mentioned, you've got natural gas and coal. You want to think about your energy base much like you would your retirement portfolio. You want to make sure that you've got a diversity of supply. If you are concerned about climate emissions, CO2 emissions, you might want to think about, for your energy security, opening the door perhaps to nuclear power. But remember, as New England learned when they had the breakdown in power throughout the Northeast, it takes 72 hours to start that power back up. That's what most people don't realize. When a nuclear facility goes down, you must have hydropower or coal or natural gas burning in order to get that power plant back up to speed. And that takes 72 hours. That is important to even know if you're in energy security. On the other hand, with natural gas prices so high, and if you have a drought, and that shift to the natural gas base and you cut out your coal, your citizens are going to be paying a much higher cost for their electricity. So you need to think about that in terms of how you can help out the environment but keep things at cost benefit. Another resource that you have, which is wonderful, which we flew over to get here, are your forests. There, I think, Oregon can lead and can contribute, because there is where you've got a wealth of supply that you can do good carbon sequestration research on. You can do some research on biomass. Now, Alec likes to wear a white hat and says, don't provide tax incentives, don't provide tax credits. If it's something that will work, the marketplace will take care of it. But you know what? I'm not a legislator. You've got to do something. We would say technologies, you heard, to get the technology to those third world countries is important to change their emissions, to change their level of pollution. Well, it's the same thing here. How do you get that innovation going in your technology? That's the job before you. Try not to get pulled into this economic chess match between the U.S. companies and European-based companies who are trying to make you change your laws so they can make some money on a credit. Be very careful.
I'd like to address the security supply issue. One point I left out, the risk is still beyond much higher cost because of the availability of that. So we have to count on the risk of money not to flow through, but for legal finance. Elevators. The proposed regulatory responses to the climate crisis have all dealt with all disaster related to supply problem in natural gas. Okay, natural gas has to come to us largely through a pipe, has to cross rivers, which we largely can't do because of regulatory challenges. Have to go through communities, which again stops a lot of pipes from being laid. Alan Greenspan just referred to his testimony twice now before Congress, where he said that the inability to supply sufficient quantities of natural gas and the price increases, of course, will fall, have hindered our economic recovery, which still obviously outpaced Eurozone, which was 4.4% last year, maybe 1.6. It would have been better, less people, fewer people out of work, if we could get more gas to market. We're talking about, we saw California, not an exaggeration to say, we're talking about California patients across the country, if you force them on coal, which is what the regulatory responses would do. Now, I did talk to the utility representatives, not anyone who, to my knowledge, supports CEI some years ago, and they changed their position. They said, well, we were in favor of this because we burn gas, but then we realized
a cap is a cap, which is a cap on our growth. And we are stuck where we are if this thing comes into place, because we realize it's not the destination. It's the first step.
All right. I think what we will do is now I ask you to kind of come around the table and face the audience, and we'll have some questions. Is the mic over here alive? So that if you'd like to ask a question for the record, we would ask that you come and use this microphone here. I think I have a list of six folks, and we'll take each one. And if anyone that's under pressure time-wise needs to get out, if not, then I'll take you in order. And I think if you have a question, wonderful. If you have a statement that you'd like to make, then I would ask with the limitations or the request that Representative Barnhart made, that you also provide where your organization is receiving its funds. Most of you, I think, or some of you here are just private citizens. But if you're with an organization, then I would ask you to follow the same rules that Representative Barnhart has asked for. First of all, Vern,
I don't have a question. I had a statement I wanted to make.
You're more than welcome to. Come on over and use the mic so we have it on record.
Which mic do you want me to use?
Right over here.
I have copies. I understood you wanted copies, so I have copies of my statement. Let me keep the top down for myself. My name is Vernon Groves. I'm a retired United Methodist pastor, and my perspective on this whole matter is informed by what I understand to be the predominant scientific view about the correlation between carbon dioxide and climate change. And this is somewhat different from what we've heard today. I recognize that there's uncertainty in everything in life, and that includes my perspective. But I'd like to read part of what my present statement says. Is this working right? Okay. I am here to ask you to vote against H.R. 3 because it would block Oregon from helping to give timely leadership on what I consider to be the most important moral issue of our time. Right now, we've got a growing blanket of carbon dioxide around the Earth's atmosphere from burning fossil fuels. It's trapping in heat, changing the climate to some extent, currently, and scientists are telling us that putting off doing something about it poses a serious threat to our future. The longer we wait, the more difficult it will be to turn this trend around. And from my point of view, the stewardship of God's creation requires that we act quickly in the hope that we can still prevent a widespread ecological and human disaster. Now, real solutions to this problem are available. They include using cleaner technologies in our power plants and in our cars and light trucks, along with moving toward more hybrid vehicles and eventually toward hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. Right now, it seems to me, we can join a number of other states in adopting California's new low-emission vehicle standards and thus help provide leadership temporarily lacking at the national level. In a letter which I and several others received today from John McCain, and probably quite a few people received that letter, he says this, and I think it kind of summarizes my concern. He says, "We have a growing crisis on our hands. I'm speaking about global warming. Left unchecked, it can we can expect glaciers and polar ice caps to melt, severe storms to become more frequent, prolonged droughts to devastate agricultural lands, sea levels to rise, and entire ecosystems to be thrown out of balance. Inaction is not just an option, because the longer we wait, the worse it will get. H.R. 3, this is my comment now, H.R. 3 comes down on the side of inaction, and I ask you to vote against it.
Thank you, Mr. Carson. Next, I'll call Chris Robertson of Robertson and Associates. Okay, thank you. Fred Hewitt from the Sierra Club. I think you probably would call in to represent the partners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I have to admit this is the first time I've ever testified standing up, but I'll do the best I can. My name is Fred Hewitt. I represent the Sierra Club. I'm on the National Global Warming and Energy Policy Committee, which has about 15 members who have expertise in various aspects of energy use, global climate, and policy. Also represent the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club, and we oppose House Resolution 3. I've handed to the committee two documents, which I hope will be introduced into the record. Both of them are versions of a paper by Roger Bezdek and Robert Wendling, which analyzed the effect of an increase in auto efficiency standards on the American economy and on the use of energy, particularly the use of oil, over the next few decades. I'll try to be brief because I think the testimony lays out our position pretty thoroughly. We don't view the economy and the environment as being separate. The environment is very important, and clearly, of course, the Sierra Club is interested in protecting and enhancing the environment, but we also think that it's important to respond to environmental threats or problems with the least economic disruption that we can. So it was interesting to hear the variety of opinions being expressed today about what we should do about this particular issue. I think we've had some substantial improvement in understanding of the global climate issue over the last decade and a half. In Oregon, we've had numerous studies going back to 1990, when the first Oregon Department of Energy study of global climate was done, thanks to a bill that I was had a hand in the 1989 session. So I don't think that we're new to this, and I think we've learned enough that the time has come to take action. The governor's Global Climate Task Force report, which is currently in draft form, and we're waiting to hear the governor's final opinion on that, lays out a very clear set of objectives, guidelines, strategies that takes the economic impacts of this problem and of the potential solutions to the problem very seriously indeed. So I hope that we'll give that full recognition and look at the kinds of things that they recommended that we all do, including Oregon's agencies. I want to turn attention to these two reports, one of which I placed out in the audience as well. Fuel Efficiency and Economy, the short version of the paper published in American Scientists, currently on newsstands, and the longer version published in a professional journal called Energy Policy. The two economists studied the effect of a moderate and then an advanced CAFE increase, auto efficiency emissions, an increase in that standard. Now, the Sierra Club doesn't just support an increase in the CAFE standard. In order to get auto efficiency to a higher level, we are not 100% in favor of just taking a command and control approach to every environmental problem. We're also interested in looking at market approaches and at consumer-led approaches and what have you. And so it's not just a question of we must get CAFE in order to get our result. It's one option to look at among many, but we certainly support an increase in CAFE, which we have not done for now for 20 years, and the fleet average in the U.S. has actually fallen compared to the mid-1980s, at the same time as we're facing the highest nominal gas prices that we've ever faced. And I might point out that during the time period we had higher real gas prices in the early 80s, also coincided with the largest economic decline in the country since the Great Depression. Those of us who were in Oregon at that time remember the very high unemployment and the very sluggish economy that we had, and the very difficult time that the state had meeting its own budgetary objectives. The two authors of the paper have presented three outcomes. One is the base case, which involves no change at all in auditor efficiency. The second is a moderate increase up to the year 2010, and then staying standard until 2030. And third would have an additional increase by the year 2015. These are not out of the realm of possibility. The technologies that they refer to were reviewed by the National Academy of Sciences and shown to be available and implementable with the current fleet. So it's not like we're talking about developing something that doesn't yet exist. At the same time, there's no question there would be a differential impact in different parts of the economy, depending on whether you're in autos or in oil or in other parts of the economy. And they show, using an input-output model, that some economic effects would be differentially distributed. Some states might lose a few jobs, but most states would gain a great many. Some states would gain a moderate amount, like Oregon. Some of the Midwest states that produce autos would gain a great deal, because this would stimulate new development in their market. I also want to point out that their model is based, for the most part, on gas prices estimated at $1.75. Now, I don't think that we're going to see that again for a long time, if ever. Given that the gas prices are likely to be higher, I would estimate that, in fact, we'll see very few, if any, real job losses with an increase in CAFE. A significant decrease, if you take the advanced approach, with emissions that will assist with reducing the effects of global climate change and also will produce a positive economic result. Helping implement these kinds of changes is one of the roles that our state agencies can play. I think that our agencies have been very careful in dealing with the issue of global climate change. We've taken a slow, careful look at this problem. We've studied it very thoroughly for the last decade and a half. We have an excellent new report by the governor, by the governor's task force, alongside California and Washington. And we have some opportunities in various sectors of the economy to start taking steps that basically are no regrets policies. But I do want to add one or two other comments. First, I'm a little surprised by the statements that were made today that were in effect saying, let's not do carbon cap and trade. I have sort of the opposite problem. It's difficult to persuade people in the Sierra Club to go with an emissions trading system. I think that's a tool that we ought to look at. And some of us on our committee are talking within the organization about looking at market-based approaches for dealing with these problems. However, we also believe that no one single approach is going to be effective by itself. We need a variety of things. And the one thing to understand about carbon or any cap-and-trade system is that the devil is definitely in the details. It matters a great deal what the initial conditions are, what the equity is in distributing the initial allocations, and also how the system operates over time. We have an example in this country, the sulfur dioxide emissions market, which is working pretty well, and an example in Southern California, the so-called reclaim market, which is not working so well, but indicates it's not just a question of whether you have an emissions trading system, it's also a question of how it's designed. So finally, just simply want to reiterate, we believe that there are approaches that can address the problem of global climate change, which will challenge us a great deal. But we think that instead of reacting defensively and just waiting for things to get worse, it's much better, knowing what we do now, to move forward and take the steps that we know will produce a positive impact, whether or not global climate change happens next year or 10 years from now or 100 years from now. To us, I think really the issue is, do we take responsibility or do we duck responsibility for the issue, that this big issue that is so challenging that faces us today? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. I guess I would find it interesting that I think you mentioned the last decade, since a lot of information and Dr. Taylor here has pretty much shown us over 1,500 years of information and scientific evidence. So I think we do have to take a long view and not just contain ourselves to the last several decades of information, but I very much appreciate your presentation. Next we have Ivan Goodstein. Is he okay?
I've also got some prepared testimony here.
Thank you.
So, create a little podium, or maybe I should just sit down. That's all right. It's sort of hard to read while you're standing up.
We have the written testimony. Could you summarize? Or?
It's pretty quick. I'll just run through it if you like.
Okay.
And I will summarize as I move through it. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Ivan Goodstein, and I'm professor of economics at Lewis and Clark College, where I currently chair the Environmental Studies program. I have a PhD in economics from the University of Michigan, and my research expertise is in environmental and natural resource economics with a sub-focus on the employment and competitiveness effects of regulation. My most recent book was called The Trade-Off Myth, Fact and Fiction About Jobs and the Environment, 1999. I'm author in addition of a number of peer-reviewed articles and reports. I'd like to address the end of the Oregon House Resolution Number 3, and my testimony today concludes, in contrast to some of the conclusions that are in that resolution, first, that some greenhouse gas emission reductions undertaken solely by individual states can in fact yield net benefits to those states. Therefore, the House should not recommend a blanket prohibition on all policies without weighing the costs and benefits of individual initiatives. Second point is that greenhouse gas emission strategies, reduction strategies pursued by Oregon in conjunction with other states will provide a framework which will be critical to any effort to significantly control greenhouse gas emissions over the long run. By providing policy leadership, states can help promote a new generation of clean energy technologies that will make it possible for management of greenhouse gases to in fact be broad-ranging and encompass all major producers, as I think all of our speakers would like to see here today. So let me address briefly the first point. There are greenhouse gas emission reduction policies that can yield positive net economic benefits. To begin, there is a well-known policy statement signed by 2,500 economists, including six Nobel Prize winners, that reads, "Economic studies have found that there are many potential policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions for which the total benefits outweigh the total costs. For the U.S. in particular, sound economic analysis shows that there are policy options that would slow climate change without harming American living standards, and that these measures may in fact improve U.S. productivity in the longer run." Now, that statement is not to say that any and all policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions would be good for the Oregon economy. However, historical evidence suggests that both government energy efficiency mandates and investments in renewable energy technologies like wind power have had net positive economic effects. Farmers in eastern Oregon, for example, are leasing wind power, leasing their land to wind farms for $1,500 to $2,000 an acre, while also providing tax revenues and jobs in rural counties. Efforts to promote biodiesel production in the state, motivated in part by efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, are also likely to produce significant rural development benefits. And current efforts underway to reduce conventional diesel emissions from idling at truck stops, a result of the Oregon Governor's Climate Task Force, are also likely to generate both economic and health benefits for truckers and the trucking industry. Talked a little bit about California clean car technology standards. Recent analysis for Washington State by the Department of Community, Trade, and Economic Development there estimate that in 2012, a new clean car will cost Washingtonians an additional $324, but will save more than $2,000 in fuel costs. Additional financing costs would be about $7 a month, but savings would be $11 a month for consumers. And as the last speaker mentioned, this information is consistent with a recent study by the National Academy of Sciences, which concluded that using known technologies, fuel economy could be raised substantially over the next decade without net cost to consumers. More broadly, clean energy industries in the Northwest show substantial promise as a basis for job and income growth. A recent study commissioned by eight Northwest and energy and development agencies from Oregon, Washington, and D.C. suggested that a clean energy industry in the Northwest might deliver 30,000 new jobs to the region by 2020. And greenhouse gas policy is already beginning to provide the incentives needed to grow this industry in the Northwest. So the second point I'd like to make is to address the points by our speakers that reducing greenhouse gas emissions are likely to be very costly. And I looked at Dr. Thorning's testimony that she presented in Connecticut a couple of months ago, in which she essentially argued the point that she made today. The tables that she presented showed a range of Kyoto compliance costs ranging from essentially zero, which was the administration's estimate, to about 4% of GDP loss. I think it's important to note that the higher end estimates were, in fact, virtually all the other estimates were all funded by industries with a direct stake in the policy outcome. Economists Robert Repetto and David Austin provided the most comprehensive analysis of national Kyoto compliance costs. They look at 16 of the most well-known models of the cost of climate control, compare their approaches, and boil down the differences. They began with 162 different predictions. The impacts on long-run GDP clustered around zero for Kyoto, and with a few exceptions ranged from mildly positive to mildly negative. They concluded predictions that Kyoto would seriously harm the economy are unrealistic. They stem from worst-case assumptions. Under more reasonable assumptions and preferable policy approaches, a carbon tax is a cost-effective way of reducing the risk of climate change and would do no damage to the economy. That was their assessment of the range of Kyoto models. In my own work, I've documented a history of both government and industry overestimates of compliance costs. For example, a co-author and I examined all the cases we could find of costs forecasts from environmental regulations for which actual compliance cost estimates were later available. In every case but one, the actual costs were less than half the predicted costs. And in the best-known recent case, the sulfur dioxide emission standard that was discussed earlier, the actual costs have been 2 to 4 times lower than EPA estimates and 8 times below industry estimates. One well-known study that was actually sponsored by Data Resources Incorporated, which is one of the firms that Dr. Thorning mentioned, concluded about the acid rain program that, quote, initiatives such as the acid rain legislation would achieve only the dubious distinction of moving the United States towards the status of a second-class industrial power by the end of the century, end quote. Needless to say, after acid rain controls were put into place, this dire prediction about cost was not borne out. Again, this is not to say that all environmental policy initiatives are costless, just that there are interested parties who often inflate projected costs. Let me briefly address my second point now, that action in Oregon in conjunction with other states is in fact critical to any long-range strategy for greenhouse gas management. It is true that Oregon actions alone, and indeed Kyoto alone, will have very little measurable impact on greenhouse gas emissions. But I think the point that Representative Lim made in terms of leadership is very salient here. Across the country, states are acting in their traditional roles as laboratories of democracy, some moving faster than others to develop greenhouse gas emission controls. If Oregon adopts California's clean car standards, we'll be joining not only our southern neighbor, but likely Washington, as well as many of the northeastern states, and just recently Canada as well. So if the California standards are implemented, in fact, the entire continent of North America will largely become a clean car market. And Oregon's legislature can step up to the plate and effectively support this effort. I think everyone is in agreement here that technology transfer is ultimately the solution to climate change. What Oregon's legislature can do by taking a step forwards now is to begin to push forward those technology initiatives in the richer countries where we have the resources to move forwards. And I think to argue that Oregonians should not reduce greenhouse gas emissions until Bolivians, Brazilians, and Indians agree to do so ignores the reality that Oregonians have the resources and the skills and the privilege of participating and working in a dynamic market economy to actually develop the leading-edge clean technologies that will dominate future energy markets. So to conclude, let me note that here in Oregon, I think this year has provided a real test case of the likely impact of global warming on our economy. Lack of snowpack this year has already inflicted millions of dollars of economic losses on the ski industry, affecting hundreds of workers and their families. And this will be a very, very punishing year for our farmers. Scientists at the University of Washington's Climate Center tell us that this will likely be our future. By mid-century, global warming could well permanently reduce our snowpack by more than half, effectively condemning our children to year after year after year of summer drought conditions. Given first that the Northwest is extremely vulnerable to global warming, second that there exist greenhouse gas reduction policies that can yield direct economic benefits to Oregonians, and third that through its policy leadership, Oregon's actions will be important in helping catalyze clean energy industries that hold the key to long-run climate stabilization, I urge the members of this committee to refrain from adopting House Resolution 3.
Thank you. I would like to give Dr. Thorne a chance to respond to some of the statements.
Okay.
couple of points. This is on. Yes. A couple of points. I would like to point out that Dr. Gunstein has made an error in characterizing the model simulations that are shown on page 3 of my testimony prepared here for the state of Oregon. For example, the highest cost estimate for the U.S. to comply with the Kyoto Protocol was produced not by industry, but by our own Department of Energy, Energy Information Administration. DOE concluded that the cost of meeting the Kyoto targets would be a reduction in 4.2% of GDP. That's the highest. Second, another relatively steep cost was produced by the Australian Bureau of Resource Economics, not an industry-sponsored study. That was the Australian government's estimate. Third, and this was not in my testimony, but in discussions with people in the EU who are doing energy modeling in DG Enterprise, which is like their Department of Commerce, they concluded, and they told me that their results are the same as those produced by Global Insight, which we did for Italy, Germany, UK, Netherlands, approximately 2 to 3%. Of GDP. So I don't think it really serves any purpose to disparage the results of models that might have been funded by industry. If you can critique the analysis and point out flaws in the models, that's one thing. But it's really not criticizing who funded the study rather than pulling apart the modeling and being able to say, well, you're wrong here, you're wrong here. I think that's a better way to go about it, and I think the results that I've shown here do stand up. And I also commend to you some testimony I delivered before the Senate Government Affairs Committee in July 18, 2001, which is on our website, that takes apart the Clinton administration's estimate that the GDP impact would be 0.14%. It points out the flaws in your analysis.
Mr. Chairman, I have 2 points in addition. On the California bill that was adopted in the Northeast, only 2 states adopted that particular bill, New Jersey and Connecticut. At the end of the session, after a lot of discussion on economics, both of those states put into place a measure to opt out versus New Jersey once they wanted to determine what the cost would be to change the fleet over, and if it was too high, then New Jersey will opt out of that. In Connecticut, the governor's plan has to be recorded back to the state legislature with a cost-benefit analysis to see what that also would do. You must remember that the transportation sector, and this is important for Oregon because that's your largest source of CO2 emissions, also has a major role in transporting consumer goods in and out of the state, and that can have a serious impact. The second point on the California bill is that it actually has not been implemented yet, and most likely what will happen, because deep within that regulation is a zero emissions, a ZED bill that nobody likes to talk about. If that is implemented, there will be litigation that will take place. So those states that have put into place a bill that adopts the California LEV bill, or ZEV bill, as we like to call it, will find themselves drawn into spending taxpayer dollars in litigation on that issue. That's something else to be considered. On the points of trading, there are very good programs with trading with sulfur dioxide, mercury, with nitrogen oxide. I want to remind everybody that every single one of those elements are indeed pollutants listed under the Clean Air Act that have a basis in human toxicity for causing problems in human health. Carbon dioxide does not. It is not a pollutant. There is not yet issued by any agency in the United States a human toxicity level in the bloodstream that would cause a problem of exposure to too much CO2. This is why I, as a nurse, got involved with environmental policy, because we see resources going from real human health problems over to environmental issues that are not necessarily narrative scientifically. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Porter, good points. First, the Clinton administration, as I said, I'll be happy to turn on my computer so we can see it. It's pulling from USA Today story. But they, after they left office and supposedly made their claims of no vested interest, political or otherwise, then backtracked and acknowledged Kyoto's cost. So it's not overly useful to use old Clinton administration claims. And as Dr. Thorne pointed out, the EIA did project some very severe costs. Enron funded most of the it won't cost us anything, and windmill welfare is beneficial advocacy, and we're supposed to listen to that because it's good, and before the running schemes were closed because it's green. Now the industry claims, which aren't described as industry claims, are from the windmill and solar panel and other industries that we benefit. So if it's inherently ineligible for consideration because industry is behind it, that means industry. Now, we're also supposed to be in a famine right now and an ice age. The very same people behind the current alarmism used to advocate in the 70s catastrophic man-made global cooling. In fact, someone, Stephen Schneider, who wrote the introduction to Lowell Ponte's book, The Cooling, also then wrote the book, Global Warming, with no apparent embarrassment. The models tell us it is currently much warmer than it is now, and we should listen to that. It's currently, if we're going to believe me, or your own lifelines, that's the argument. The observations are wrong. The models are wrong. Now, clearly, just disparaging something because of the plunging doesn't make any sense. And finally, the entire premise of Kyoto is that this is costly. That's the entire argument for only covering the wealthy countries. We're the only ones who can afford it. But we can argue out of both sides and say, actually, it won't cost us anything. Well, good, let's include everything. Wait a minute, it's very costly. That's why we're only covering the wealthy countries. We're having it both ways, and this is what I said, well, let's just return to a more rational level.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I just want to bring one personal experience. I was down on a business trip last weekend in California and saw in Indio, California, I saw the vehicle emissions office. And so I quick turned around and back and went in and asked, explain me a little bit about vehicle emissions because we're going to be covering that in several weeks. And the owner said, well, I guess I'm not the right one to talk to. He said, I'm about to close this shop because there's so much fraud in the system. I can't stay in business. I'm trying to honestly tell people whether they have an emissions problem or not. I have competitors all over the city, all up and down the valley, that are basically doing fraudulent tests, telling the people that they need to have repairs, then doing another fraudulent test to show that they passed the emissions test. That's a sample of one, and certainly not to be taken very seriously, but it sure made an impression on me that if we're asking to take the California standard, I think we better look at it very closely before we get to the meeting. Chris Hagebaum is where it is. Great. Hope I didn't butcher that, Chris.
Thank you. And if you don't mind, I'm going to have some water. I've been sitting there all afternoon.
Thank you.
Chair Anderson and member of the committee, my name is Chris Hagerbaumer. I am a program director at the Oregon Environmental Council, and I did prepare testimony in opposition to House Resolution 3 because I believe that this is set up to lead into that on Thursday. Just a couple of points. I'll be very brief. In our look at the science, we see that there's really no credible argument against the fact that human activity is changing the climate. This is reported by the IPCC, which in its most recent assessment states unequivocally that the consensus of scientific opinion is that the climate is being impacted by human activities. These declarations come from more than 2,000 scientists that are participating. I think it's important to know, in what's the largest and most rigorously peer-reviewed scientific collaboration in history. And it's not alone in its conclusions. If you look at scientific bodies in the United States in recent years, those whose members' expertise bear directly on the matter. They have issued similar statements, including the National Academy of Sciences, the American Meteorological Society, the American Geophysical Union, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And here in Oregon, just this last summer, a group of PhD level scientists got together and issued a scientific consensus statement on the likely impacts of climate change on the Pacific Northwest, which I have here, but I only have one copy, so perhaps I could hand this to the administrator to make copies for you all to look at before Thursday. And in this consensus statement, I think it's important to look at what climate change means to Oregon. The scientists concluded in this consensus statement that our region is warming, average annual precipitation has increased, land on the central and northern Oregon coast is being submerged by rising sea level, and the region's snowpack has declined precipitously. And it indicates these trends are going to continue. You can read about those in here. I do want to mention one thing about climate change and human health. While I agree completely that there are toxins, my organization works on reducing toxins and the threat that they pose to children in particular, but climate change will also impact human health. As temperatures increase, you'll see more unhealthy air days because hotter summertime temperatures generate more smog. A longer pollen season will make life more uncomfortable for people with asthma and allergies, and cases of insect-borne diseases such as encephalitis will increase. The clean car standards that were passed or regulated in California were based on the fact that they see global warming as having a human health impact on Californians. So I want to say also briefly that the fact that global warming is happening in and of itself poses significant economic costs. A risk to our economy, global warming in and of itself. Look at Oregon's ski industry, agriculture and forestry. The Capitol Press on November 19, 2004 stated, quote, agriculture in the Pacific Northwest will be vulnerable and need to adapt, such as change when, where, and how irrigation is done, develop crops that are more drought tolerant, and deal with new pests and diseases. In addition, although it's true that the science is not as strong about what global warming means as far as storms, floods, fires, and so on are true, there has been a great increase in insured loss from natural disasters over the past four decades. And earlier speakers, Eben Goodstein, spoke to some of the other economic analyses that have gone out there that say that dealing with global warming is something that can be done in an economically feasible and not in a cost-effective way. So basically, I just want to say that I believe that we in Oregon must act, we should lead, we have the capability to do so.
Thank you. I'm a little confused by how we can look at only a short period of time as opposed to a long fabric of time. I think Dr. Taylor's slides that show that I'm not quite sure how you deal with the variation that came over the last 2,000 years or so, that this has been happening over a long period of time.
Well, Chair Anderson, I would suggest that we have another scientific expert, perhaps from OSU, come and address that issue. I'm not a scientific expert, but if an international panel has been looking at this issue for many, many, many years and has come to the conclusion, and they are looking long-term. They aren't just looking at the last 50 years. They're looking long-term. So I would suggest that we have another person besides Mr. Taylor come and talk about that. And also, just with respect to this issue, I think that climate skeptics throw out this issue that, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, we were talking about global cooling. But my understanding is that much of that work around global cooling was not put out in scientific journals that were peer-reviewed, most of that was reported by the press rather than being reported on in scientific journals. So I don't think that argument really holds much water.
Which makes me wonder, because I never hear this viewpoint in the press. Never. I hear one side, and yet there are thousands of scientists on this side that are claiming that there are other facts out there. Thank you very much for addressing me. Jenny Holmes, I think, is last. Excuse me. Okay. We are under pressure now from staff to get back to Sam.
Chair Anderson and member of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify today. I'm very pleased to present testimony on HR 3. My name is Jenny Holmes, and I am the Program Director, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, and coordinator of the Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign. A broad spectrum of our nation's faith groups, evangelicals, Catholics, Protestants, and Jews, are united in one of the Holy Scriptures' first commandments to humankind, to till and keep the garden. That's Genesis 2:15. From this mandate, we believe that creation is a gift of God, not to be used selfishly as we please, but to be tended for the well-being of all humankind, both rich and poor, from generation to generation. This is the principle of stewardship or creation care. There may be many things some religions disagree on, but on this matter, we share the same basic understanding of our responsibility as stewards of God's creation. A recent document issued by the National Association for Evangelicals reflects this religious consensus. NAE's For the Health of the Nation, an evangelical call to civic responsibility, states that Genesis 2:15 implies that the principle of sustainability, our uses of the earth, must be designed to conserve and renew the earth rather than to deplete and destroy it. We urge government to encourage fuel efficiency, reduce pollution, encourage sustainable use of natural resources, and provide for the proper care of wildlife and their habitats. On behalf of the Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign, with over 20 participating denominations and faith groups, I'm here to express our concern that a bill like H.R. 3 is even being considered by our legislatures. The values embedded in this bill are out of alignment with the religious values of fundamental human justice and stewardship. H.R. 3 reflects a concern primarily for industries, mostly not located in our state, that may have to make some changes in order to protect God's life support system and to prevent suffering and death by the world's poorest and most vulnerable people. We agree that now is the time to take action on the fact that there is leading world scientific consensus that global warming is real. Our national leaders have failed to take action. This is a black mark against our nation's character as a just, generous, and caring nation. States like Oregon should be interested in protecting the well-being of its citizens from the harms of global warming. There is solid science on the negative impacts of global warming on agriculture and forestry, provided by groups like the University of Washington Climate Impacts Group and others. The early melt of snowpack in drier summers would be devastating to these industries. We are not only concerned about ourselves, about citizens of Oregon. The commandment to love our neighbors as ourselves means that we must take responsibility for the harm our nation is creating. As the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference say in their statement on global warming, global climate change, a plea for dialogue and prudence on the common good, which extensively quotes John Paul, who has departed us recently. The commandment to love our neighbors as ourselves means that we must take responsibility for the harm our nation is creating. Our obligations to the human family tie us to the poor in our midst and across the globe, as well as to future generations. The commandment to love our neighbors invites us to consider the poor and marginalized of other nations as true brothers and sisters who share with us the one table of life intended by God for the enjoyment of all. We encourage you to drop H.R. 3. This bill is not good for Oregon. It is not good for God's creation. It's not good for God's children, especially the poor. This bill is morally flawed in our eyes. We hope that our representatives will put on a good set of moral and ethical spectacles in addition to cost-benefit analyses, which have been talked about so much today, when you consider this bill. It promotes a view of the world that the Earth's most powerful nation is not responsible for its actions. Is that the legacy you would like to be known for? Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Captain Panera, I believe you have some questions for the panel. David, before you come, I would like to ask from each of you that do come from an organization, Fred, Chris, Jenny, that you do submit the statement and submit it to me, and then I will take those from the others and make them all public. But until we have equality, I don't think it's fair to ask of these people or anything that your organizations wouldn't do it as well. Catherine.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, Catherine Banana, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association, a regional trade association compromised of a majority of the pulp and paper mills in the Pacific Northwest. I am one of three employees of the association. We're not a large group. My question is to the panel, and it has to do with your worldwide and nationwide perspective on what happens in a state when regulations are imposed that are not imposed in neighboring states, and you have companies or competitors that move across the border, perhaps have facilities in both states, and what happens to those companies in those states, but also what happens to the flow of capital within those companies when decisions are to be made for reinvestment of capital in facilities when you have overly burdensome regulatory policies in one state.
Okay. I'll go ahead and start and then defer to my other colleagues here. An excellent example would be Arizona, the home state of Senator McCain, who is talking about global climate change and the impact it will have. What was not mentioned to you is that in recent years, Arizona has built power plants along the California border. Because California was restricting the building of power plants, Arizona built them instead and sells power to California and the Northwest states on natural gas, fuel, fossil fuel. That's an example of what can happen. Business unfriendly state, so to speak, develops regulations that put in barriers, and so the businesses look for states that are more open. And so you have this leapfrog effect of businesses going from one place to another. Another point that could raise happen within your own industry with forestry in Maine, with the paper mills up in Maine. There was a heavy regulatory climate put into place, and what has happened now in Maine is that several of those mills have closed. They were the bread and butter of many small towns in Maine, and last year, over the past 2 or 3 years, approximately 6 or 7 towns have closed up their municipal governments and have now joined the state because they don't have a population base to bring in the revenues to support a government structure at the town level. So you have fleeing of population. I think Colorado is another example of how Californians who could not do business any longer in California emigrated to the state of Colorado and moved up to neighboring states. So there's a population loss there. So that's a natural consequence to heavy regulatory barriers. Businesses do indeed look for business-friendly climates to set up shop, and that's what brings jobs in. We talked about renewable energy sources as possibly being a new income level, a new revenue source for companies. That may or may not be the case. We really don't know. We've seen a lot of jobs outsourced to other countries in the past 2 or 3 years. Most of the states that I mentioned last year, 110 bills were put into place. Only 16 were enacted out of those 110 bills. Why? 47 states were in budget deficits. They simply could not afford to do it. It's been the same thing each year. So this movement towards regulation in this area has been going on, but it's been gradual, it's been very slow, and it has to do with the economic climate of each individual state. Most of the states simply cannot afford it. The reason why Oregon can afford it, as I mentioned earlier, 73% of your energy base comes from water. You can afford to put regulations in place that don't impact water. But natural gas and coal, which are you only have a portfolio of 3 energy sources here, I warn you, that's not good. That's the problem. So they do leapfrog around.
I had the interesting pleasure of seeing in December in Buenos Aires the World Wildlife Foundation complaining that the Inuits would not be able to subsist on club seals and the like if the Arctic were warm. I did not think I'd see something like that in my lifetime. Now I think I've seen a replication when I saw you and the ski resort industry defended by the environmental pressure groups. That's times definitely are changing. The EU has already threatened to bring WTO actions against us, modeled on the Shrimp Pearl case, whereby protectionism is okay if it's done in the name of greed. Why? Well, they're proving all we need to know. The same thing Margot Wallström said. This is about leveling the playing field for big businesses worldwide. They can't compete if we don't do this. Same thing, and we're the least of their worries, because most of the world is exempt, including most of the people who compete with them more aggressively than we do. So, the short answer is, we're talking about a ration. It's a cap. It's a number. It's tangible. You put your hands on it, you get your hands around it. If you exceed it, you cannot operate. This is ration. This is a weakly disguised effort at redistribution. That is the only viewpoint under which you can find acceptable seeking mandatory rations only in the clean and wealthier countries and leaving these countries where the jobs will go exempt. This is a very weakly disguised effort at redistribution, and so that's what happens. Wealth gets redistributed, jobs get redistributed. And what we'd like to do, Project Congress in the 90s, is to include in the cost what happens to the dietary, the diets, the use of tobacco, alcohol, spouses, and other things that happen when you lose your job. Include that in a cost-benefit analysis. And it was prohibited because it was just too hot button, but those things happen.
I'd like to just follow up on what the other two panelists have said so far and also commend to you this 2-pager fact sheet, which is on our website on the state of Oregon. It's been implemented the McCain-Lieberman and the New England Governor's Plan. By 2020, manufacturing in Oregon will be down by approximately close to 2%. And the energy-intensive sector will be down by about 4.5%. Jobs will leave Oregon. Industry will leave Oregon. So if you want to look at some quantified data, take a look at the study that was done by Global Insights, international known consulting firm.
Dr. Thorne, do you want to also respond to the
I would like to just briefly respond to both Jenny Holmes and to the retired Methodist minister. One of the things that we need to think about is while climate change is very important, a critical issue, other issues are equally important for the well-being of our fellow creatures. For example, that was held in Denmark, the Copenhagen meeting that Bjørn Lomborg, the Danish environmental scientist, hosted last year, was really top Nobel Prize-winning scholars, mostly economists, concluded after the results of their year-long effort that the world's worst problem, the worst problem facing us is AIDS,
the spread of AIDS, and second, I think, is dirty water, lack of potable water. And they had 10 top problems, which are available on their website, and climate change wasn't even listed in terms of the top problems that are actually killing people. So it seems to me if we do hold to the philosophy of trying to love thy neighbor as thyself, which I think is a wonderful aspiration, we ought to be looking at what's really killing people today and how can we work on not just climate change, but a variety of issues that will help alleviate poverty and alleviate the childhood deaths, which the World Bank puts at 5 million per year. Parade Magazine this Sunday puts at 10 million per year due to disease. So my point is economic growth can help alleviate the poverty that so many people in the world suffer from. It can also help to find solutions for climate change. And I think it's certainly true that the targets and timetables approach to reducing greenhouse gas emissions will worsen poverty, slow growth, and make it harder to alleviate the problems that are facing us today.
One sentence. It's always helpful for policymakers to consider the multi-denominational community's input, but as you pointed out, it could be both sides, and there are both sides, and I'll just suggest the Cornwall Declaration, led by Father Robert Sirico and read by Anna Lappin, among, I think, several hundred others, should also be taken into the record.
Thank you. Jenny, you want to know?
It's not a question for the religious community of either economic well-being or environmental integrity. It's a question of combining them, because we work on climate change doesn't mean we don't work on aid, we don't work on poverty. We work on climate change because we are concerned about those things, and we see climate change exacerbating all those problems. So to be responsible to our Creator, we must address the long-term and the short-term. And it's not so long-term anymore. So for a very wide group of religious leaders that think this is a priority. Thank you.
Jimmy, I would ask that you also submit a statement in terms of the finances of the ecumenical ministry. With that, I thank you all. We've been very, very patient. We've had a lot of good information on both sides. I want to thank George Taylor and Dr. Thurman, Chris Hunter, and Sandy Lee Warren. You've all presented us with some very, very challenging information. And with that, I will close the informational hearing of the Committee on Environment.